This is the regular board meeting of the Glen Ellyn District 41 Board of Education. The meeting will now come to order. The time is 7:30. Mr. Kenwood, will you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mrs. Moe, roll call, please.
Mr. Escalante?
Here.
Mr. Kenwood?
Here.
Mr. Elder?
Here.
Mr. Bochinski?
Here.
Mrs. Nelson?
Here.
Mr. Ellis?
Here.
Mr. Bless?
Here. Public participation. We do apologize for the limited space that we have tonight, but we are doing summer construction, and with technology deliveries in our other buildings, this is the space that we have. So please be respectful to your neighbors. There is a Glen Ellyn police officer here present to assist us if we need any assistance. And hopefully we do not. We welcome public participation, but due to the volume of emails we received relative to the board's previous action surrounding the recommendation of the reconsideration committee and from parents representing Y41 regarding their views of the think tank. Is anybody here that wants to talk about the think tank tonight? Are you all here to talk about the book?
Yes. We
requested only new information be presented this evening. If the group is someone who can serve as a spokesperson, that person may speak for each group's perspective. If you wish to speak but your views have been substantially presented by someone else, please submit your written comments on the green form to Nancy Moog. Nancy, can you raise your hand? And we will record your name and having expressed an interest in addressing the Board of Education. Your name and comment will be reviewed by the board and reflected in the minutes. If a representative person can speak for the views of a larger group, girls, please consider this, we will allow up to 5 minutes. If that is not possible, we will limit your comments to no more than 3 minutes, as been our custom. If you've spoken previously, we'll limit your participation to 1 minute. Public participation will be limited to no longer than 1 hour in order to conduct the board's business in a timely fashion. So it's time 7:32, so we're going to keep to that timetable. We're going to alter our agenda just slightly and begin with the presentation of the Teams for Excellence. This will allow the groups to identify a spokesperson or to submit green forms to Mrs. Moe. After the presentation, we will return to public participation.
So if there is any green forms that still need to be submitted, or if you decide you want to have a spokesperson for your group, you may quietly try to organize that and do that while I'm doing just a presentation of our Teams for Excellence and give you, the board, our annual update on our Teams for Excellence. So we'll begin with our building leadership team, and let me just give, because we have so many people, I just said to someone else, I've never done an annual report on the Teams for Excellence with such a great crowd, so thank you all for coming our Teams for Excellence report tonight. The Teams for Excellence in District 41 represent the model that we have in place for continuous improvement, and we have several teams that operate under that continuous improvement model. The first team is our building leadership team. And that is otherwise known in some school districts as the school improvement team. But its role is really larger than that, and it looks at the whole building's culture while looking and examining how our students are doing, how our school climate is doing, and how we are improving on an annual basis. We refer to that team as the BLT. The next team that we have, and you don't need to move, don't move a slide that way. The next team that we have would be our learning leadership team. And the learning leadership team, commonly referred to as LLT, has always taking care of our curriculum and learning it matters and done all of the work that comes before the board as it relates to program evaluations, curriculum review, and adoption of new materials. That team is now being called Team 21. It has been revised, and its charge, while inclusive of curriculum, has changed slightly to become the innovation engine for the school district, where they will do the research, they will make sure that we remain at the cutting edge continuously improving school district, and will make their recommendations annually to both the Board of Education, the Teachers Association, and our Support Staff Association. The next team is our professional development team, and that team is responsible for aligning all of the professional development of our district along with Team 21 and the long-range plan initiatives that are present in the district at that time. And finally, the continuous improvement team, which is the system team that overlooks all of the continuous improvement structures that are within the district and looks to take responsibility and further the goals of the long-range plan. The long-range plan is something that drives the district in all aspects of our work. It's a five-year plan and built around two-year action plans. So without further ado, let me give you a quick overview of each team's report for this year. The BLTs all reported to CIT, the Continuous Improvement Team, in May, and talked about their accomplishments for the year, the areas of focus, the school improvement goals that they have. And so while not talking about each individual school and its strategies, I'm presenting you simply with an overview of what the whole group, themes that came out from the whole group. A lot of emphasis on writing. All of our schools are looking to improve writing, looking to do that across the curriculum and doing it in a variety of ways, and they'll continue that. Additionally, a great deal of emphasis this year has been placed on the learner characteristics and how do we embed the district learner characteristics, which were adopted by the board in 2007, into our day-to-day life and into the work and the goal setting of our students. And so that work has been a tremendous success and cause for celebration this year among our BLTs, and that work is something that we were really, we charged the BLTs to make that an emphasis for this year. We've seen an increased look at whatever it takes in all of our schools, that wherever there's a gap in a child's learning, that it's all hands on deck. No matter what your role, no matter what you're teaching, we all work together in terms of meeting the needs of all students. And so that has been a strong initiative at all of our BLTs this year. We've looked at how can we increase parental involvement to the extent that one of our schools has taken a problem-based learning approach to it and created a staff PBL, or a problem-based learning project, on how can we increase the participation and involvement in meaningful ways of our highest risk parents and populations. And of course, we looked at increased students meeting their growth targets in both math and literacy on the math. And so that kind of summarizes the accomplishments of our BLTs and what are they looking to do next year. Next year, they want to deepen the implementation of those learner characteristics in the daily life of students, in the goal settings of students, and in the way that we structure our lessons. Additionally, they want to continue deepening the work that we've begun on the implementation of new Common Core standards and what that means for classroom instruction at every level within the system. Next year, the BLTs will be supporting and monitoring the implementation of 21st century learning, which is content specialization at level 2, which is grades 2 and 3, and level 3, grades 4 and 5, as well as monitoring the multi-age approach in grades 4 and 5. We'll continue to do goal setting around math, both for teachers and for students, so that students set goals for themselves in reaching their achievement targets, and monitoring how close they come to reaching those targets. And then we'll also be looking at next year, how do the incoming PARC assessments, those assessments which we decided to come before, coming to us in 2014, and what we can anticipate, and what our MAP scores, our student achievement scores, can tell us about how we might predict we'll be able to do it. So that's BLT in terms of this year's successes and accomplishments, and what they plan to do for next year. Next slide is LLT. And LLT, again, is the Learning Leadership Team, now known as Team 21. And this is a district-level team. This is made up of representatives from all of our schools and representatives from administration and from all of our stakeholder groups. This year, they identified 10 learner characteristics that they wanted to make sure were emphasized throughout our schools and looking to add another 10 learner characteristics to that next year. But they also developed this year a survey to test how students feel about their own progress on the learner characteristics and how students might self-assess. And we're really looking to that assessment as something that will help us monitor student learning at a level much different than standardized measures could offer us. They created I Can statements for students to be able to use with the learner characteristics and another variety of things attached to the learner characteristics. So as you can see, this year's focus for all of our teams has really been deepening our understanding of what 21st century learning should look like in our students and what 21st century classroom should look like. The LLT was charged also with looking at the new foreign language curriculum and the dual language curriculum, and that's really basically how they concluded their year. the new team, which will be next year, is our Team 21. We can look at the next slide for what Team 21 will be doing. They began that transition in April once we concluded the year, and we're ready to set up the new team. And so Team 21 is now taking charge of the next steps. And most of their work will be the transition to 21st century learning and looking at the recommendations that came out of the think tank back in November. So creating a structure, many structures, for finishing up that work, as well as developing an evaluation tool for that, looking at the social-emotional development of students, and then again, fostering and developing and further testing the assessment that we want to see students do as a self-reflection on the learner characteristics. Their work is a primary driver for the professional development team. And the professional development team concluded its year with several accomplishments. And if we can go to the PDT slide. The professional development team this year revised its evaluation tool for all of our professional development. Each time teachers engage in professional learning, they evaluate the impact of that learning, both in terms of satisfaction as well as in terms of will I implement, what is the likelihood that I will implement my new learning. They use that feedback to help guide any new professional development. So a new form was developed there. They have done an exceptional job of aligning the professional development that takes place each year to the long-range plan and the priorities of the long-range plan. One thing this year that I think was really special and to the credit of our AFSCME representatives on PDT is that they developed a support staff professional development to occur on every day that we had a school improvement activity in the afternoon. They continue to focus on the learner characteristics and 21st century learning as a thrust for them over the next several years. And we continue to look at differentiating our professional development in order to meet the needs of the different stakeholder groups within our professional team. So nurses, psychologists, OT, PT, music teachers, PE teachers, our AFSCME staff, various groups all have sometimes unique designs to their professional development because the needs of meeting literacy or math are not really the needs that they may have for professional development. So, what is PDT going to do next year? They will be working to support the implementation and recommendations from Think Tank in the 21st century, or Team 21. They'll continue to look at the development and support that is needed in the long-range plan initiatives, and they'll continue to deepen their understanding of applying the standards that come out of Learning Forward, and Learning Forward is an organization that was common, what used to be called the National Development Staff, the National Staff Development Council. And they have standards for what professional learning should look like in our schools and how to assess the effectiveness of that. And our PDT team has continually looked at those standards as a guidepost to them in building meaningful and impactful professional development. And finally, they'll continue to refine and use feedback from our staff in terms of shaping professional development. Next and finally is CIT. And the continuous improvement team is the team that is made up of also teachers, administrators, community, and it is the strategic group that overlooks and sees what's happening in the whole system to ensure that there is alignment with the priorities of the district and to ensure that in all aspects of our work we are always have a lens towards continuous improvement. The focus this year in the action plan that the CIT created was really focused on deepening and broadening knowledge around the continuous improvement, around the long-range plan. And with particular focus around the learner characteristics. So for the last 2 years, we've been trying to figure out how to brand, how to create energy around 21st century learning. And those teachers in the room know that there are 21st century learning t-shirts that we have used and worn on special days in order to create energy around 21st century learning, but more importantly, create ownership. And ownership ultimately being ownership with students. That students own their learning, and that our goal over time is to ensure that in partnership that we are working in order to create an environment where students own their learning, they take charge of their learning. And so you see at the top, see it, know it, own it, was
a slogan we built for ourselves this year, that we want to be able to see the learner characteristics. We want people to know it, that they are out there, that they are a vital way in which we apply 21st century learning, and that ultimately we own it. We own those learner characteristics. They are a part of what we do on a day-to-day basis. So see it, know it, own it. We feel like we made great progress on that this year, and we had an action plan that we created. We stuck very close to it, and this is a group that meets only once a month, as do all of our teams, and so they got a lot accomplished in the year. We held a summit at the beginning of the year with all of our teams for excellence in order to emphasize the importance of the learner characteristics and the long-range plan. And we began to see evidence of 21st century learning as members of the continuous improvement team, representatives from both of our unions, representatives from all of our teams for excellence did walkthroughs of our building and looked at physical evidence, things we could say that really reference 21st century learning, and in particular the learner characteristics. So what's next for CIT? Well, we want to expand the communication plan that would bring the greater ownership to the learner characteristics in the long-range plan. We have a district scorecard that has been in flux with the new long-range plan initiatives, and so they began to do that work now, plan on finishing a renewed scorecard so we can monitor and record our continuous improvement. We will be creating a new new action plan for next year. We want to monitor the implementation of 21st century learning through the think tank. That's our responsibility to report to the board. And, of course, assist then, and really another important piece is to deepen the interconnection between all of our teams for excellence and help the new superintendent make a transition to a continuous improvement culture. So overall, I think one of the things to highlight for this year is that the great success of creating a strong interconnection among all of our teams for excellence, creating a solid message, a single message about moving towards a 21st century learning organization, being fully aligned with all of the actions that we were taking, whether it be from looking at curriculum and the work we need to do to get ready for the Common Core, plan our professional development, and really see the development of student ownership in all their characteristics. So, in a nutshell, that is the work of the team, and thank you, Board, for supporting that and for having us do an annual report each year. Are there any questions? I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions or comments from the Board?
I've had the pleasure of, as former board president, being assigned to serve on CIT as the board liaison representative, and I can attest to what Ann is saying in terms of how much work gets done in such a short amount of time. It's a very focused group. It's two-hour blocks of time. They're set aside from 4 to 6 p.m., and just a lot of great work, especially with a team as large as that. Anybody who knows it's been in a meeting, it can digress pretty quickly. But as Sam steps into that, you know, he'll have the opportunity to see how deep those conversations go and what we're looking to accomplish. So it was a very good couple of years and a lot that got done in that amount of time.
I just had a question. Is the BLT involved in the dual language program? Is that just an LLT?
Well, the dual language was created through through the work of bilingual teachers, a curriculum committee that reported to LLT. The BLT at Churchill, where the program will be housed, will help monitor and look at their school improvement process along with everything else that's going on in the school.
So we are getting BLT engaged with those.
Sure, of course, because it's their students.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, thank you, Ann. So moving back to the public participation, please keep in mind this is a business meeting, so there will not be a question and answer session. It's only public participation only, no answers from the board. Let's get started. Mrs. Moog, do we have anyone who wishes to make a comment?
Hearing none.
Good. Sorry, before we get started, Mr. Cooper, at the time is 7:50, and as I stated before, we're going to limit this to an hour, so we'll try to accommodate as many folks as we can. and we'll see where we get, how far we get.
Mrs. Cooper is a representative.
Mr. Cooper, are you a representative of any group, or are you speaking on your own?
Yes, I'm speaking on behalf of the Hadley Literacy Teachers.
Great.
First, I want to thank our board for your timely consideration. I'm Brett Cooper. I'm one of the 5 eighth grade literacy teachers at Hadley. I am very sympathetic to those who are upset by this book purchase. In many ways, I am a conservative, yet I support the repeal of District 41's book banning. I want to tell you why. My wife, Julie, and I live in Wheaton. We grew up in Wheaton and Glen Ellen and attended Glen Ellen schools. We've adopted 4 boys, now ages 15, 13, 12, and 9. As devout Catholics, we go to church at least once a week. We pray together, and we talk about our faith. My wife and I are rather strict in our house, for example. We don't allow certain video games, such as Call of Duty and Grand Theft Auto, games that many of our boys' friends own and play often. We take seriously our responsibility to raise good, holy men. 2 years ago, I gave our 2 oldest boys a birds and bees talk. It lasted 2 hours. We then watched and discussed a 4-DVD set about the sanctity of marital sex and faithful love. My goal was to ask and answer tough questions, to do my best to explain why we believe what we believe. I was raised Methodist. When I was 14, I lost my faith. I was an atheist from 14 to 28. As an inquisitive teen, I thought there were no good reasons to believe. My long journey to belief required humility and prayer. It also required answers to my questions. Many of those answers came through reading. I read dozens of books and considered many religions and philosophies. Reading about different viewpoints helped me to know and understand. The Perks of Being a Wallflower is a graphic work of fiction, yes. It includes obscene language I never used, though I once did. It features teen characters doing many things I hope my kids never will. I will respect any parent's decision to guide a child toward other reading choices. Yet I think it's wrong to say that Perks is inappropriate for middle schoolers in general. In this ultra-connected age, young people face countless challenges and temptations. Books like Perks help kids to anticipate what they will likely encounter. Parents may benefit, too, by reading the book, discussing it with their kids, and contemplating alternative responses to similarly challenging circumstances. I hope we can agree that we are all sinners. We are all in this together. More importantly, I hope we can agree that each of us is infinitely valuable. The Perks of Being a Wallflower deserves a spot on school library shelves, because his characters are infinitely valuable sinners, also known as ordinary people, from whom our kids can learn. Thank you.
I'd ask that you refrain from clapping after every response. We're going to take away time from everyone else if we keep time clapping. So, save your applause to outside at the end of the participation, if you would. Thank you. Mrs. Moog, who's next?
George Smith.
Mr. Smith, are you speaking on behalf of a group or on?
I'm speaking as a parent and as a religious leader in Glen Ellen.
Good luck getting.
Can I get to that?
My name is George Smith, and I'm the parent of 3 children, all who have attended Hadley Junior High School, and I serve as rector of St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Glen Ellen. I also participate in the Glen Ellen Religious Leaders. I normally preach for 10 to 11 minutes. Under 3 here. Staying on the sidelines in matters of education is definitely not a perk of being a wallflower. So let me be clear. I am opposed to banning or removing the book in question or any other book. I have read this book. Charlie is a young man in the 8th grade and then as a freshman in high school. This book is about his observations, honest observations about his life, his family, his friends, and experiences in school. This book has the ability to spark good thinking and discussions among peers and within families. I believe that this is a question of freedom, education, and freedom in general. Forbidding, banning, removing books has shades of dark times in our history, religious and political. I think about the Inquisition. I think about the Nazi regime and Soviet repression. Where does the banning stop? Is it any complaint that will ban a book? Now, the Bible is unquestionably more offensive than the perks of being a wolf. Would you ban the Bible? I offer my perspective as a parent and as a leader of the Christian faith. And I urge you, as proponents of 21st century learning and students taking their own learning for themselves, not to ban this or any book. Thank you.
Thank you. Mrs. Monk, who's next?
Caitlin Palmasano.
Caitlin, are you speaking on for yourself or for the group?
I'm speaking on behalf of myself. Kids are already, of course, constantly exposed to inappropriate conversation and situations every day. But why does that make this okay for kids to be reading graphic descriptions and scenes on these subjects? The content in The Perks of Being a Wallflower is far too mature for some junior high students. As an 8th grader who read the book at the very start of this year, I was shaken and caught off guard by the text. I was only given a small warning of the content by my teacher telling me that it made her blush. I felt not only that the book was inappropriate, but the valuable lessons it is said to be taught were in no way instilled in my mind. For me, if any lesson was learned at all, it was definitely the bullying hurts. Many say this lesson was learned. However, through the situation at Hadley, many students against the banning were being bullied themselves. One person in particular suffered a torturous few weeks, as others blamed her for the removal of the book. This showed me that even though the argument was to teach the book for the valuable lessons to be put into use in students' lives, they contradicted that by doing the opposite of anything the book may have taught. On another note, I have heard many times that censorship is wrong. Censorship is used throughout society. For instance, we cannot get into an R-rated movie under the age of 17, and no one fights against it. So why is this different in a novel? Given the content in the book, in order to make the film PG-13, numerous scenes need to be removed. A film using word-by-word text from the book would have been rated R based on content. So book censorship should be no different. I feel that there should be a compromise so that when a student would like to read the book, it is mandatory to have a parent signature so they are fully aware of what their child is reading. Thank you for taking the time to listen to my presentation.
Thank you. This is Moe, who's next?
Lisa Rittinger.
Okay, am I speaking on your behalf or part of the group?
No, I'm actually speaking on behalf of the Brad.
Okay.
The Brad question. First, like I said, I'm here in support of the Brad bill, and I'm going to read an email that I sent to a school official. We appreciate your prompt reply to our inquiry. We're afraid that you may not be getting the whole story about what has transpired in these teachers' classrooms. We were made aware that Ms. Lewis and at least one or more other teachers, including Ms. Tannenbaum, used class time to share their views that the board's decision was unfair, that it was censorship, and that the students had a voice. We are quite at a loss as to how you can tell us that the teacher said nothing inappropriate and that all they did was direct students to their parents. This statement directly contradicts a number of different people's versions, including other 8th grade students. It is our understanding that a number of people brought this attention to the school. In addition, how can you explain to us how appropriate it was for these teachers to have worn pins and necklaces to school that read freedom, F-R-E-A-D-O-M, and stop banning books? Even if what you told us is factually true, that the teachers were not supposed to address these issues, they were still addressing these issues by wearing pins and necklaces. We have some questions for you all. If what the direct witnesses involved in this matter have said is true, that these teachers did, in fact, voice their opinion on this matter in their classroom, what effect do you think this had on the students? Do you think hearing their teachers, adults, speaking out against the who and how this issue came to be would significantly color their views? Are teachers supposed to be looked up as a source of knowledge? Even if some students say that they're old enough to make their own decisions, we all know as adults that others' opinions matter. Why else do we have meetings such as board meetings, work meetings, etc., if what others say doesn't impact our views? Even if what you stated is true, that the teachers did address the students, which is contested by a lot of people, what effect on the mood of the students did the wearing of pins and necklaces that read freedom and stop in book have? Although it certainly isn't any teacher's intention to be part of why a child is bullied, what responsibilities do teachers in general have when they promote contentious issues that end up with the bullying of students? So much that this particular student was unable to go to school for several days. If the information was already out there amongst the student body, do you think the pins and necklaces that the teachers were wearing helped quench some of the students' feelings, or did it actually pour gasoline on an already inflamed and contentious issue? Given the inflamed situation and how much controversy it created, and given the fact that a girl was a victim of bullying yesterday, how wise do you think it was for former board member Tara Costa Howard, who voted to keep her, how appropriate was it for her to quote this book at an 8th grade graduation?
30 seconds.
Okay. And to Sir, Mr. Cooper?
Ma'am, please address the board only.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I just wanted to say to Mr. Cooper, would you teach perks in front of Jesus, in front of a holy God?
Thank you. Mrs. Moe, could you please announce the next three names, and those three folks line up at the podium and be ready to speak?
Carly Bassler, Mark B. Giacomo, and Steve Slate.
Thank you. Carly, it's come to my attention you've spoken before. Are you speaking on your own behalf, or are you speaking in front of a group? Or?
On my own behalf.
All right, so you have 1 minute.
Okay. I'd like to thank the board for letting me speak tonight. So take a tent and a strong wind. Without one stake, the tent could blow away and be gone forever. Now take my friend, who's on the verge of taking her life. This book could be that one stake that keeps them on the ground. In the book, Charlie said, I had an amazing feeling when I finally held that tape in my hand. I just thought to myself that in the palm of my hand, there was this one tape that had all these memories and feelings and great joy and sadness right there in the palm of my hand. And I thought about how many people have loved those songs and how many people got through a lot of bad times because of those songs and how many people enjoyed good times with those songs and how much those songs really mean.
30 seconds.
I think it would have been great to have written one of those songs, and I bet if I wrote one, I would be very proud. I hope the people who wrote those songs are happy, and I hope they feel enough. I really do, because they've made me happy, and I'm only one person, and that's what this book has done for me. Now, just like the perks has taught me that there are people out there that care and love me for me. Not it's okay to have sex, do drugs, and drink in high school. Sometimes you have to back up and look at the whole view, because the closer you think you are, the less you actually see.
I was sitting on the floor. He said to have the youth sit on the floor.
Sir, you spoke before.
I have spoken before, so I know.
We'll give you 1 minute.
And again, thank you, board.
Sorry, could you tell us your name again, please?
Oh, sir. Mark Giacomo.
Thank you.
And you've heard me speak before, but thank you again for listening today. And I can't see you and the great writings of the conference, but I'm up here to say that words matter. The spoken word, the written word, they light up parts of our brain. And the more that the brain is lit up, the deeper those words impact our psyche. And I would ask the students here, I would ask the adults, to think about a time when words stung and how much that scars your emotions. But also think about the times that words have been uplifting to you and how much that has helped you maybe through tough times.
30 seconds.
There's been an argument made that they're exposed to this type of literature and this type of sexual content, etc. Anyway, and I say how sad. But do we, as a school board, do we as a school need to go down that same path? Would it not be better for us to be a beacon and a light to our students? And I just want to close with a comment from Corey Tamboon. She was gathering her courage to ask her dad a question that had troubled her ever since she read a poem in school. Finally, she said in a low voice, "Papa, what is sex sin?" He said, "When we get home, I want you to carry my heavy tool bag to the house." "No, the bag is too heavy for me." "Yes, and I would be a poor papa to ask his young daughter to carry such a heavy load as understanding what sexual sin is. Please trust your parents. Please ask parents permission." That's me. Please.
Thank you. Please tell us your name and if you're representing yourself or a group.
My name is Steve Slate and I represent Illinois Home Educators. I'm not part of this community, but I am a reading specialist in the area. And I'd like to quote several phrases that come directly from your website regarding your mission and values. According to the site, three learning characteristics that describe students here are they're compassionate, respectful of others, and nurturing. Your value statement says that you should expect honesty, integrity, ethical behavior of all members of your learning community. I think in order to determine the right action as to whether or not to ban this book, it's only logical the board look back at your vision and mission statement that's already in place. I was planning on quoting an excerpt from page 31 of the book. Because of its mature content, I think I'll summarize. On this page, Charlie looks on as two teens stumble into his room drunk. While he watches, a boy forces a girl to pleasure him sexually, even though she repeatedly begs the boy to stop and says no over and over again. Some would argue that this is not technically rape. What's interesting to me is that even Charlie, the main character, feels sick. He knows what he's saying is wrong. It's gross. It's a violation of a girl's rights, sense of blatant disregard for her feelings and desires. Referring back to the mission of District 41, I ask the community, is this act in the book integrous? Is it an example of compassion with thought for other human beings? What messages are we sending, particularly to young men who read this book about their treatment and views of women? I realize other books geared towards young adults tackle hot-button issues, but the author of Perk seems to pack everything from having sex with animals, suicide, homosexuality, sodomy into one package at reaching kids in their teens, early teens. And frankly, I don't think the average 14-year-old has the maturity or wherewithal to determine whether or not this content is appropriate for them. As literacy teachers, we're already encouraging our students to think critically about texts, to analyze and take away the application to your life, to visualize what's happening, and to gain a more understanding. Given that the district's stated goals are that students show compassion, they live with integrity, they show decency to their fellow students and adults, there are other remarkable pieces of literature that we know that can exemplify these traits. There are other literary pieces that are not filled with raunchy material. It's difficult to comprehend parents in Glen Ellen approving of this book. Matter of fact, 67% of parents on Common Sense Read say this book is way too inappropriate for children or teens. In conclusion, I'd like to apologize for the behavior of the literacy specialist at Hadley, who, from what I've read, actually recommended perks to students within their classrooms. Any time it's given, it should be more than perused to determine if the content is acceptable. Anyone with common sense, after reading even a small excerpt, should be able to determine that this book is simply inappropriate and shouldn't be available in a public school setting. As a parent of four daughters, I'd be completely outraged. After all, by having the book discussed and reviewed, my child would be exposed to the content that I deem completely inappropriate. By allowing it to be read and discussed, the teachers basically took away the rights of parents to determine whether or not this was acceptable. Parents blindly trusted the teachers, assuming the content was appropriate. I urge the board to consider fully banning the book perks. It does nothing to build up a young man or a young woman's sense of self-worth or foster any sense of decency whatsoever. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd have to ask again to please refrain from clapping. We'll have to ask you to leave if you do not respect others and the board. Thank you. Mrs. Moe, can you call the next three?
Edna Hetherington, Mary Ann McCluskey, and Maddie Rakowski.
Do you want to stay there?
I'd like to stay for a year.
That's fine.
That's fine.
I live in this school district, and my 3-year-old granddaughter lives in this school district. And I only want to say that I think that it is both wrong and stupid to ban books and to be removing books from reading lists in this manner. And it gives me a bad opinion of the school district where I'd like my children to be going to school if it's going to get into this business of censorship. Since the religious question seems to be important, I'd also state I'm a church-going Christian here in Glen Rowan. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next?
Miriam McCollum-Heister.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm here tonight basically on behalf of myself as a Glen Rowan property taxpayer, about half of whose recent taxes have gone to 1541, having junior high. Also, I'm here kind of by coincidence because I was out of town 2 weeks ago. Went to a bookstore, picked up a short book because I'd forgotten the book I was reading at home, and bought Perks of Being a Wallflower without knowing there was any controversy surrounding them whatsoever. So I read it with a very open mind. I was quite overwhelmed by the number of rather deviant problems that were presented in one short book. Drug abuse, promiscuous, hetero and homosexual sex, abortion, incest, domestic violence and abuse, and even a mention of bestiality. I was thinking that all these issues could be pretty overwhelming to just about any reader. But I think my objections to the book actually are as follows. I think that despite any literary value that might be obtained from this book, the content is so extreme in both language and in providing graphic details of all these things, sexual encounters, that it far overshadows any possible benefit for this age group. And I think the other thing that struck me is, far from being an exploration of these topics, I think it's presented in a very in-your-face kind of acceptance type of way. And I think there's very little exploration of it in the book. one example is this, that when Charlie takes his sister to an abortion clinic to get an abortion, there is absolutely no examination of what is about to happen. There's no thought about taking a human life, and no thought that even this very important action should be discussed with their parents, who seem to be good parents. Also, one of the things that I find very inappropriate about this is using the word censorship or banning in regard to a book for middle school. Censorship, in my view, would be trying to take the book off the Glen Ellen bookstore shelf so that nobody could read it. Censorship in a middle school, I would call guidance or text selection. And I think the responsibility of the teachers here, of all the literature in the world, is to provide something that's enlightening and inspirational to the students.
30 seconds.
I think parents should be the ones to decide what's appropriate. There may be people this age who are would benefit from this book, but I think the real question here is how much input do parents have in the education of a child in a public school, and how much input does the taxpayer have as to what the choices are. So I would urge you to find a better selection for this type of issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next.
Maddie Rakowski.
Maddie, you can stay right there if you like. Mrs. Boat, can you call the next three somewhere?
Sure. Barbara Kelsey, Roy Garman, and Adrienne Fair.
Okay, sir, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Maddie Rakowski. I recently graduated from Hadley Junior High. And throughout my 3 years at Hadley, I was involved in the Gifted Literacy Program. And in the Gifted Program, while I was there, I was surprised to hear that Perks of Being a Wallflower was banned, because the books that we were reading in Gifted Literacy had content that was similar to or more intense than the book Perks of Being a Wallflower. For example, we've read the books Huckleberry Finn, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, and Fahrenheit 451, which are all highly disputed for the mature content and the language use. We also have an entire unit on the Holocaust, which contain books like Mouse 2, the graphic novel, and the book Night, which all contain explicit, gruesome accounts of the Holocaust. So overall, I just wanted to make the point that Persevering Wallflower is not the only book that we are reading in eighth grade that has mature content or adult material. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, please state your name. Are you speaking on your own behalf?
I'm speaking on my own behalf. Barbara Kelsey, Maddie's mom. And I just want to say that the best job I have is being a parent, and I want my ability to parent be left to me and ask you to not put it on or to make the decision from the board to ban books. If there's something that I think is inappropriate for her to read, I will let her know. Mrs. Mann was her gifted literacy teacher and was very open during curriculum night and told the parents that there would be controversial material available and said if anyone has an issue with it, to come see me and we would talk about some alternatives. So I just want to say that I think that's where it should stay.
Thank you.
Good evening, Board President Black and other significant board members.
Sir, could you tell us your name, please?
My name is Roy Garner.
Are you speaking on your own behalf, sir?
Yes, I am.
Thank you.
Grinnell has maintained an excellent reputation in prison for many years. And, in fact, I know this personally because in my 41-year teaching career, 28 of those years have been at Havre. And having a literary knowledge of Burks, this book is not healthy for this age level. It doesn't present a healthy influence in this age level. But if a student is determined to read this book, they have every opportunity to read this book at a local library, at a local bookstore, or order it online. But it should not be a part of any school library, let alone the excellent reputation that Hadley and Glen Ellen has maintained over the years. This purpose should be to maintain quality moral character in our schools, starting at the elementary school and continuing through high school at Glenbard West. A pastor in a Western suburban church received a message, a crumbled up message from his offering plate, and it said, in kind of a nervous handwriting, "Dear God, why did you allow the shooting at Columbine?" And he signed his name. And the pastor read that note, and the next week meditated on it, prayed about it, and wrote the following note back to the student. I would have, but I was not allowed in school. Sincerely, God.
1 minute.
So I'm supporting the decision that the board has already made and passed. And I'm requesting the board to table their vote.
Thank you. Please tell us your name and if you're speaking on your own behalf or on behalf of the group.
My name is Adrienne Fair, and I'm speaking on my own behalf.
Thank you.
So thank you and good evening. I am a lifelong resident of Glen Ellen and a recent graduate of the University of Illinois this past spring. I can tell you about roommates that I've had in college that I've heard crying in the shower as they try to wash away the dirty feeling of having a one-night stand. I can tell you about hundreds of students walking around Green Street Champaign every night, going home with the first person that catches their eye and promises them a good time. I can tell you about five people I know who died this last school year, four of them suicides. But all of this would sound like something out of a fiction novel. Actually, it kind of sounds like the book being discussed tonight. except for one difference. What I'm saying actually happened. It's a day in my life at the University of Illinois. It's not a story, but a testament to the reality of my life. Here's a quote from the book being discussed tonight. I just need to know that someone out there listens and understands and doesn't try to sleep with people, even if they could have. I need to know that these people exist. All of the students that I just spoke about are screaming the same thing to themselves every day. They are 21-year-old men and women, so scared and wounded they rot. Langston Hughes describes the feeling best when he wrote, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a sugary sweet, syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode?" They're asking you, teachers and parents and board, to help for help, but are you listening? Are you giving me more to read about my own life? Are you showing me lives and books that mirror my own life perfectly? Instead of showing me leadership strength and how to save myself, are you actually showing me that there's no way out? Hey, at least I'm being shown that I'm not the only person in pain. I'm one of hundreds of other invisible flowers on a wall. If the people in the book can't make it out, how can I? If no one will listen to them, who would listen to a 20-year-old woman? And if no one would listen to me, then who would listen to a 14-year-old and a child? Why give me a book that reinforces the bad examples I already have when you could be teaching me and leading me with good examples? Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mrs. Moore, the next three, please.
Brian Bukowski and Sue Show. Linda Samuda. Molly from
Five. Good evening, I'm Brian Bonkowski.
And I'm Sue Show. And we are the co-presidents of the Glenna Ellen Education Association.
And thank you for the opportunity to speak tonight.
It's our hope that our remarks on behalf of the teachers and the association will be useful in helping our school district and all its stakeholders address an issue that has recently arisen, a legitimate educational issue that has brought forth valid and appropriate viewpoints from many different constituencies. Until recently, a book called The Perks of Being a Wallflower was part of 8th grade classroom book collections available to students as options for independent reading. A debate has now arisen over whether this book is appropriate reading material for 8th grade students. To put this into some context, bear in mind that ours is not the first school district in which controversy has arisen over the selection of appropriate materials. Debates of this kind have emerged throughout the history of education in our country. The book in question, Here and Now, may be relatively new, but this is not a new debate. The reason this type of discussion can become emotional and controversial is because people, real people, parents, teachers, administrators, school boards, and stakeholders on all sides of the issue care deeply about their children, their students, the education system, and their values as thoughtful adults and citizens.
There's no doubt that the parents and citizens who object to the use of a book are caring and concerned about their children and about students. Let there be no doubt about the teachers either. As teachers, we are devoted to making sure our students learn and grow into the responsible young people we all want them to be. Excellent teachers know it's important for students to consider diverse viewpoints, controversial subjects, and new ideas. At the same time, parents have every right to know that school is a place where their children will be taught and cared for in a way that is appropriate to their values and understandings. It's a reasonable expectation. There are solutions to this debate. Reasonable adults will look for thoughtful solutions to challenges just like this one. We can use this as an opportunity to show all children that considering different opinions can lead to good solutions. And that's an education they can use throughout their lives. As members of the Glenn Ellen Education Association, we're committed to making sure this education system, our school district, meets the rightful needs of all its students and their parents and community stakeholders. We look forward to working with you towards successful implementation of solutions that will address the interests of all concerned.
And we do have a copy of our remarks for the board, if you would like that.
Yes, please. Thank you. Go ahead when you're ready. Please tell us your name and if you're speaking on your behalf or on behalf of the group.
On my behalf.
Okay.
My ten-year-old daughter attends St. John's School in Lombard, but I felt the spirit of my views, not only as a taxpayer, but as a concerned parent. She was not a taxpayer, but a taxpayer.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Sure, I'll try to last week I heard about this book controversy, so I researched first in my first year of school, even as an adult was shocked. Now, this may be a personal viewpoint, but the thing that an education system will provide 13-year-olds with this type of book describing sex acts and using the F word doesn't seem possible. If this book had photos of what it describes, there's no way it would be allowed. So why do we allow our teachers to bring a book into our schools for our children to put into their brains? A website called Common Sense Media leaked this book for 16-year-olds. I would caution parents to have the option of opting out of this type of book even in this book. This website also rated the book 2 stars out of 5 for educational value and 4 out of 5 stars for sexual content. Why would a book with low educational value but high sexual content be in our schools? Parents, we need to wake up and see what is going on in our schools. It is up to us to take responsibility to teach our children right from wrong in our own views. We as responsible parents and responsible teachers do everything we can to protect and educate our children from predators on the street, predators on the internet, and to use responsible language with others. It is up to us as parents to keep our boundaries safe. When I drop off my child at school, there's an expectation that they are being taught by responsible adults and the care they are given is given to learn is age appropriate. It's scary to think that a parent drops off their children and this is the material they are exposed to at the school they trust. Then they bring it home to our safe boundaries. Imagine now that one of these children has left the book out and younger siblings have come across it. Book teen ratings the same as movies. The book was made into a movie and rated PG-13. The book is not PG-13. This is like leaving out porn or, from what I'm told, 50 Shades of Grey. Would that book make it into our schools? This is not about censorship. This is about what is good for our children. If parents want their children to read this book, then check it out in the public library or buy it. Just don't bring it into our schools or into my home. Thank you.
Thank you. Mrs. Moe, could you call the next three, please?
Patty Gibson, Megan Murphy, Deborah Stone.
Thank you. Could you tell us your name and tell us if you're speaking on your own behalf or on behalf of the group?
My name is Mara Chebecca, and I'm speaking on behalf of my group. One of the valuable lessons purchasing a wildflower has taught many people is the message of tolerance and acceptance. Ironically, these lessons have been lost for many, and the debate of whether to ban the books and reread it heavily or not. Through this whole process, my friend who was in favor of limiting the book's accessibility was being bullied terribly by those who viewed her opinion as unacceptable. People have argued that the content of the book is something we as eighth graders already know about anyway. Page 25 of the book reads this. After a few minutes, the boy pushed the girl's head down and she started kissing his penis. She was still crying. Finally, she stopped crying because his penis was in her mouth. I don't think you can cry from that position. I think it was important to read this from the text because it shows how uncomfortable it makes me to speak these words. Even though eighth graders are familiar with these subjects, images can still appear in the student's mind long after the books have been read and valuable lessons are disregarded. Personally, I believe the book shouldn't be available in classrooms, but I also understand some have a completely opposite viewpoint. A compromise could be made by keeping the book in the classroom, but sending home a sheet to parents asking for permission to let the child read a specific book first to be taught. That way, it's made sure that the parents know what their child is reading, just like when we have to get permission to watch certain movies in the school.
and because of the explicit content of his book, I think permission is highly recommended. Realistically, a student could start reading a book at school before their parents are even aware. This compromise is to protect those who aren't ready for the content. In this way, it's up to the parents to decide whether they want their children reading the book. This book has things such as kissing penises, kissing and touching breasts, masturbation, straight sex, gay sex, drugs, abortion, alcohol, language, suicide rape, and overall completely inappropriate subjects, and that's the majority of the book. Although we are aware of this stuff, it is not for middle school students. Older high school students will be more mature and ready for it. And I'd also like to repeat the fact that even though the book was banned from Hadley Junior High, it is still available in public libraries, so if it is important that someone needs it in their life, they can go and get it on their own. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this evening. I'm hopeful that we can reach a compromise on both sides of the issue.
Thank you. Tell us your name and tell us if you're speaking on behalf of the group, which it looks like you are.
Hi, I'm Maddie Gibbon, and I'm speaking on behalf of a group of great girls who are defending against the banning of Persevering Wallflower. So we're aware that the board members have been in contact with many supporters of our fight against banning the book, and we know they've all seen the videos from Judy Bloom and our own video. We just would like to give a brief overview of what we have accomplished over the past week. We have gained some of the community's support by having our flyers hung up in many stores around Glen Ellyn. We have gotten over 600 views on our promotional video. We also got tweets of support from authors such as Stephen Jabosky, the author, Neil Gaiman, and Judy Bloom. There's also been over 800 signatures signed on a petition against the banning that was made by Kristen Ginger. We have been featured on Fox News, where they displayed parts of our video that I made. Judy Bloom also talked about us on Windy City Live, the Chicago Tribune, and donated $5,000 on behalf of our efforts to the NCAC, or the National Coalition Against Censorship. She personally has put in so many efforts to keep this book alive to students in District 41. We have also received several articles written about us from the Daily Herald. Our hashtag that we created, Keep the Book Alive, has had around 80 reposts, and our Twitter account has been mentioned so many times over this past week. You know how hard our efforts have been to unban the book, and we hope you take this national exposure into consideration. As you make your final decision, we would also like to let you know that we've used our skills that we've learned in District 41 to raise our voices and to become individual thinkers for times like these, so we are able to stand up for what is right and what we believe in.
Thank you. Who's next?
I'm Deborah Caldwell Stone. I represent the American Library Association. I also have a personal stake in this issue because I have very close cousins who live in Glen Ellyn, and they have attended and will attend District 41 schools. Over the last week, we did send a letter from the American Library Association to the superintendent and the board, and I hope you received it. If you haven't, I have copies with me. I'll be happy to share it. But we want to speak in support of rescinding the ban of Persevering Wallflower and in support of independent reading as supported in the classroom library. Such independent reading is really important for the educational process, and we support the recommendations that were made by your reconsideration committee in regards to notice letters sent home to parents, as long as that means that access to the books is maintained in the classroom library. I reemphasize that this is independent, voluntary reading, and different students have different maturity levels and different needs in literature. And the school, as a public school, should support a broad range of diverse literature in the classroom library so that you meet the needs of every student in the school. Having the solution that has been proposed by your reconsideration committee, we think, is a fair solution to a controversial problem. And we would recommend that you adopt that vote. I do want to provide a point of information. Common Sense Media has been cited twice here tonight as a source of information on Persevering Wallflower. I do have their app on my iPhone, and I do want to let you know that in the overall rating for the book, they give the book 4 stars. They do give individual ratings about certain aspects of it, but they do rate it for 3 stars for positive messages, 3 stars for positive role models. Summary of the book, they call it a tender coming-of-age story that's easy to compare to Catcher in the Rye, and they consider the mature content, and they recommend that parents who are concerned about the mature content should read it with their kids. I know many young people who have had and dealing with controversies over PERC who have drawn a great deal of value from this book and encountering situations in their own life that they compare to their own lives. It may not be suitable for every child, it may not be suitable for every parent, but as a public school district, you need to support the families who do themselves believe that access to this literature is valuable for their child as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next.
I'm Megan Murphy, my business
planner. Megan, Mrs. Moe, can you call the next three, please?
Sure. Brian Smith, Edward Young, and Zach Palmisano.
Sorry to interrupt you. Can you tell us your name and if you're speaking on your own behalf?
I'm Megan Murphy. I'm speaking on my own behalf. I was a graduate of Catholic Junior High. I've attended Glenelg schools my whole life. I live in Wheaton now. I'm currently a graduate student for elementary education and middle school at the University of Illinois Chicago, and I just ended up here after class. So I didn't plan to speak, but feel really passionate because I didn't enjoy my time at Hadley. I had teachers like Mr. Garman and Mr. Bankowski, and I did enjoy some classes, but overall felt really alone. I didn't have a good group of friends, and perhaps if someone had introduced me to book PERC Savino Wallflower, I may have found some support through literature. I think it's important to remember that we need to trust our teachers and make them empowered through being able to make their own decisions and understand that there are different reading levels, but that students should be able to discuss these issues with their parents. And if parents have issues, they can discuss it at home and bring it to the teachers for consideration and make certain accommodations. So, just
Poor
PERC.
Thank you. Next, please.
Yeah, my name is Brian Smith, and I'm the father of a Glenbard West High School student who previously attended Hadley. I'm also the father of an Abraham Lincoln Elementary School student. That is primarily why I'm here. My experience with my older child at Hadley was generally positive. Of course, not everything that you're going to have in a public school curriculum is going to correspond with what I, as a Catholic father, is going to teach my child about how the world works. We have a pluralistic society, and I accept that. So he attends religious education, and we obviously reinforce the message at home. There was some Hadley curriculum that I did find objectionable during my earlier son's tenure there. Fortunately, though, we were able as parents to work with the teachers and agree on material that was not objectionable to us. So I felt very positive about that interaction with the teachers at Hadley. The reason I'm speaking with you tonight is that I understand there's a proposal that would take away my capacity as a parent to decide whether my child is exposed to objectionable material. I'm not, talking about radioactive material. I'm talking about material that we don't really discuss at the dinner table, and I would prefer it not be discussed at school as well. Of course, I know some in the room are going to urge me to get real because my precious little one is going to be exposed to it sooner or later. Well, I vote for later. I also vote for parental control, and I would ask the school board to vote to support my rights as a parent to guide my child's education. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, please. Mrs. Moe, can you call the next three while we're...
Sure. Sylvia Owen, Lino Michelli, Christina Savell.
If you feel as though you don't have to go to the podium,
oh, okay.
So if you're just ready to speak, sorry, sir. Go ahead. Tell us your name and if you're here on your own behalf or on behalf of a group.
My name is Edward Young. I'm here on behalf of myself and my wife. Couldn't be here tonight. We have been 45-year residents of Glenelg. All six of our children went through the Glenelg School District, and they have done very well. She is a clinical social worker and a psychoanalyst, and she would tell you that this book is inappropriate for this age of children. You brought up a short thing. Trust is a two-way street. I think it is important for teachers to have the support of parents in their work with students. To foster and earn that support, teachers need to acknowledge and support parents' concern for their children's moral and spiritual integrity. Parents do their best to protect their young children from degrading images and obscene language on TV. We should be able to trust teachers who will protect their young children at school. In the case where there is a dispute over a book, teachers should offer a book that does not contain obscene language or degrading situations or other disputed elements. There are tons of wonderful books out there that would fit that bill. Teachers and parents must cooperate for the good of the children and the community. We would say we're not exactly for burning the book, but if anybody wants to read it, I'm sure they can get it at the library.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Zach Ponsano. I graduated from Hadley Junior High. I'm going my junior year in Glenbard West, and I wouldn't want to use the word banning, because that's not what I really advocate for. Before I speak, I want to say, I want parental consent, and I'm sure that's what a lot of people on the side against me would like. Not necessarily banning the book entirely, but having parents have control over what their kids are reading. Now, to clarify, I haven't read all of the book, but I have seen the movie, and from what I've heard, the movie has a lot less than the book contains. And I know the main argument that a lot of you have is that the message of the book is essential for students to have. Now, it seems that this has been kind of ineffective, though, as I've heard plenty of stories of bullying going on, and considering the whole message of it is anti-bullying, all that, that's kind of ironic, I would say. But tonight, I think we can all agree that no opinions are really going to be changed. So I think what's necessary is a compromise to be reached, and obviously banning the book is not a good option, but I think allowing entirely free access is not a good option either. So parental consent is necessary, I'd say. For example, in AP European History, at the end of the year, we were going to watch The Pianist as a supplement to our learning after we took the AP test. And now that movie is rated R, and it has a very good meaning, obviously, about the Holocaust and that, and it is very relatable to the material we're going over. Now, we still needed the permission slip to watch it. And the movie does not really contain as much graphic detail as the book does, and I have researched on that. And still, sophomores in high school, we had to have permission slip for that. Now, I'd say that would be a very reasonable thing to have to read this book. That's my stand. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Ma'am, go ahead. Yes.
Hi.
Tell us your name and if you're here on your own behalf or on behalf of the group, please.
I'm Sylvia Owen, and I'm here for myself. Okay. First of all, want to thank you for the opportunity to speak. I am not from Glen Ellyn. I am from the West Chicago Winfield area, and I was involved in the some schools and helped in the library and that type of thing. So I know a little bit about some of the things that go on for that. But mine are sort of personal comments that I was going to be making. It was just yesterday, as a matter of fact, that I became aware of the situation of the book that we're speaking about that was going to be used as part of the curriculum for 8th grade and would sometimes be used in the classroom setting, and it would be just generally in the classroom. Now, from what I'm hearing now, maybe you had made some arrangements that it would no longer be used in the classroom, so all kids would be exposed to it. And if you did that, I think that's a wonderful idea. I'm concerned for some of the ideas that are being presented to young impressionable minds. The ideas presented in the book currently being discussed are ideas which are appropriate for discussion. I believe the when, where, and by whom the discussion should be led is of major concern. Many of these matters, I believe, come under what I call
family-oriented issues and values. The parents, as first teachers of children, have the primary responsibility of helping to determine what is taught, especially in moral issues and family values. My hope would be that thoughtful consideration would be given to any materials used, and that materials would be presented in a caring and a positive situation and manner. With respect for family values, and as the basic unit, the family is the basic unit of society, and that shared responsibility for education would have, would, so that parents would have their input. Thank you very much once again for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. We're approaching the hour mark of our allotted time. Mrs. Moak, do we have any members of the audience who wish to speak on any other topics? Sorry, go ahead. Anyone else? Nancy?
Emily Barton.
Okay, sorry, go ahead. Tell us your name and if you're here on your behalf. Or
my name is Shana Siddall, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself. I'm a sophomore at Glenbard West, and I graduated from Hadley. I read Perks of Being a Wallflower this summer. I was going to high school, and what I noticed is all the great things the book talks about, like being with the people you care about most, finding out who you are, experiencing life, and forgiving yourself. But it also has topics like sex, drugs, alcohol, and violence. Then again, that's reality. High school has this too. You read it in the newspaper, hear it on the radio, see it in video games, and witness it in the hallways and on the streets. This book doesn't tell us anything our generation hasn't heard before. It has, in fact, reinforced the unhealthy aspects in our society in order to improve them. Our community hides too many things, shelters us too much. We label things as good and bad, nice and mean. Instead, we embrace problems rather than try and hide, face them rather than just dub them as something we can be open with each other. If we confront these matters in the home and in the school, it's unnecessary to ban a book that confronts them as well. We cannot take a book off Hadley's shelves that teaches us to participate in life, forgive ourselves, and embrace the teacher. We cannot ban it from Hadley because it's a middle school. And that's the time in our lives when we are unsure and need this book most as advice and guidance. So as Charlie said, even if we don't have the power to choose where we come from, we can still choose where we go from there. We can still do things, and we can try to feel okay about them. So let's choose to face these topics like drugs, alcohol, sex, in the home and in the school. Let's be okay with the fact that kids are going to face these things firsthand. Because as a senior from West put it, I wish I had read Perks of Being a Wallflower before high school, so I wouldn't have been such a rude awakening.
Thank you. Is it Mr. Cooper? Going once. Mr. Cooper?
Coming around. Ms. Barton.
Who's, Mrs. Moak, who's next?
Ms. Barton.
It's a little different subject matter. My name is Jeff Cooper from Glen Ellen. We're going to talk about a financial issue that's going to get voted on tonight. According to the board report on the agenda for tonight, assistant principal ran in 2004 to address the demands partially of the growing size of the school population. But that isn't totally accurate. What is accurate is that the district, having extra taxpayer money from the 2001 referendum, fiscal responsibility be covered. In 2010, assistant principals were reduced by two, with one of them getting some new title. I'm not sure if this was a new position. This was due to budget concerns and the extremely low CPI. Now please tell me, if the economy hits a major upturn that I and everyone else isn't aware of, I don't think so. District 41 principals, teachers, and the Teacher Association have expressed concern that added responsibilities are beyond the current capability of administrative support. In a real world, we learn to work harder. If our current administration can't work harder, then hire, as one of the new board members suggested, part-time people. Personally, as one of your taxpayers, I don't give a rip about the Teachers Association concerns. They don't give a rip about us taxpayers. According to the board report, the superintendent recommends spending about $200,000 a year with benefits for the hires. That is over $1 million in 5 years. Do other school districts have assistant principals for similar sized schools? Have we even bothered to survey local comparable districts? Well, I can say this. I have a family member running a special ed program in D304, it's in Geneva, comparable school enrollment, and magically they don't have a full-time assistant principal. I've listened to 3.5 hours of audio of the May 28th meeting, and what I heard was a retiring superintendent selling way too hard the reasons that she thinks we can't live without these positions.
Mr. Cooper, please refrain from personal comments.
My feelings from what I heard, I spent 3.5 hours listening.
Thank you.
I'm not calling names. I'm just telling you what I heard.
Thank you.
It sounded like, you don't want me to say let's pad the payroll as I'm leaving, so I won't say that. I do commend the new board member who asked his common sense questions and didn't rubber stamp things.
30 seconds.
Bravo to you. I asked him and the rest of the board to vote against this recommendation. And please remember and never forget that you represent us, the taxpayers, not the superintendent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mrs. Barton.
Is it Mrs. Barton, please?
Hi, my name is Emily Barton, and I am a resident of Glen Ellyn. I have 5 children, ages 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9. And I am a lawyer. I went to Yale Law School. I clerked on the Federal Court of Appeals downtown. I don't practice law now. I raise my kids. A handful. But I am here on a narrow question, which is First Amendment rights of children. And I read an account, you know, I have no idea exactly what the facts were, but I did read something that was troubling to me, which is that evidently the teacher told her students that their parents and the school board were violating their First Amendment rights by not having this book. And I am here to say that children in public schools have very limited First Amendment rights, and that is a fact. So what she was telling, or he, I don't even know if it's this year, he was telling his or her students was not truthful. This makes a lot of sense. Do we want children in schools walking around talking about blowjobs? Do we want them talking about bestiality, abortion, wearing pictures of these on their t-shirts, having the slogans printed on their t-shirts, bringing them up in speeches? You know, what these taxpayers want our children talking about in schools are high ideals. We want them to be learning reading, writing, arithmetic, and we want them to be graduating and going on to be productive members of society. Book banning is a sexy phrase, but this is curriculum making. That's what's going on here. And that is the job of the school board and, of course, the teachers. But it is the job of you all who have been put in place as our fiduciaries to do that for us, because we're just little taxpayers. We write our checks, but we can't be there to do that. And we want the adults who are responsible here to step up to the plate and make sense of a situation that seems to have gotten greatly out of hand. Just off script, I went to a fancy private school downtown growing up. There was a lot in our library that I wish I had never seen, even visual images. They are images that are still in my mind to this day, and that I regret having ever seen. It was a very, very, very progressive school.
30 seconds.
Last comment is that I brought this up to a friend of mine who lives in Glen Ellyn, and she said, well, that's why I send my children to a private school. You know, not all of us can afford that. I would ask that for those of us who can't, that you make the right decision tonight.
Thank you. Okay, we've reached our allotted time for the participation. At this point, we're going to move on to the next item in our agenda. Those of you who did not get the opportunity to speak, you may leave your comments with Mrs. Mogan in the back if you wish. and she will make sure that they are distributed to the board. Thank you. Mr. Kevin would like me to add that there is public participation at the end of the meeting. If someone would also like to stick around to use that opportunity. Going back to presentations, reports, and initiatives, the 2014 tentative budget.
And I'm looking to see if Mr. Cicerella,
there he is.
Thank you. Mr. Cicerella will be presenting the budget overview. This presentation precedes your discussion of the tentative budget. We're requesting that you take action on the June 24th meeting to put the budget on display. Presentation provides you with just an overview of the budgetary process.
Ladies and gentlemen, please, we're trying to conduct a meeting, so if you wish to leave, we respect that, but would you leave quietly?
Yes.
Thank you. If you wish to remain, could you also remain quiet? Thank you.
So this evening I'm here to present actually the board's first review of the 2013-14 tentative budget. Last week and 2 weeks ago at our finance meeting, we had a brief overview of what was going to occur with regards to the budget. And this evening I'm here to present you with the new board members and finance committee members a little bit of information in terms of how school district funding occurs, the method we use for accounting, in the budgetary process. So, fund accounting. In education, we use a method called fund accounting. It's not based upon profit or loss, but rather we have specific areas of revenues and expenditures that are accounted for in particular funds. There are 9 funds that we currently use in our budget, and you'll see a presentation shortly in terms of what all those funds make up. Our basis of accounting is we account on a cash basis. When our financial statements are prepared by our independent auditors after the end of our fiscal year, which will start to take place the first week of July and really conclude in November, early December, then we have a modified, those numbers are presented on a modified accrual basis. If you were at the finance meetings earlier this evening, you'll notice that I gave a brief presentation of the budget process, and that is something that really occurs over really almost a full year, certainly nothing that occurs within a month or two or three. It's something that involves all departments, all buildings, and occurs generally over the better part of a year. Again, this is the 2014 tentative budget. Again, we report on a cash basis, daily transactions and our monthly reports. The board receives a monthly treasurer's report as well as several other reports, which include our investment reports. Those are all included on a cash basis. And then annually, as I said, our independent auditors provide an audited financial statement based upon a modified accrual basis of accounting, which is promulgated by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. Again, I spoke earlier, we have 2 major accounts that we use, obviously the revenue and the expenditure accounts. The revenue accounts are by the structure is you have a composed of a fund, which would be education, operations, transportation, and so forth, and then a source of the fund. Is it locally generated, state generated, or federally generated? Our expenditure accounts are composed again of those same funds that I spoke of just a minute ago, but also a function code, which generally describes which area of education it supports, and object codes, which is salaries, benefits, purchase services, supplies, materials, and so forth. The location, where those expenditures are going to be spent, whether it's at a particular building or a particular location or department, and then again, where the source of those funds are coming from. And then, because of reporting requirements in the state of Illinois, all school districts are required to use account structures that are based upon the Illinois Program Accounting Manual. And generally what that's for is, there are 900 school districts throughout the state of Illinois. And so that the state can publish financial numbers annually, and you can do some comparison back and forth between school districts, they're all pretty well tied into the same structure, so that there's some comparability amongst school districts. I spoke just a minute ago of the funds that we use in accounting, education, operation and maintenance, our debt service fund, transportation, our retirement funds, capital project, working cash, tort and life safety. Education is by far and away the greatest area of expenditure for us. And we do very little really with tort, life safety. We levy very minimally just so we don't lose the right to levy. It does not increase the amount of levy that we're allowed to levy in a particular year. So our local revenues, they are property taxes, corporate personal replacement taxes, interest earnings, student fees can be the fees that are generated. The parents pay us, the kids are coming into school annually. It's also part of our lunch program. Any other student-generated fees. Then we have our state. And I will tell you, about 92% of our revenue comes from local sources. And we have our state revenue, which is our general state aid. And we have our categorical aids. Our categorical grants. We receive approximately $3.1 and $3.2 million from those grants, and that has been an area of discussion among school districts for the past several years, and that we don't frequently know exactly how much we're going to get or when we're going to get it. And then finally, we have federal revenues. Our federal revenues have varied anywhere from about $450,000 to $700,000 a year. Obviously, you're talking about almost a $50 million a year budget, so it's a very small contribution to the overall budget. When I spoke earlier about expenditure functions, I spoke about the 1,000 direct instructions, and they run from 1,000 all the way through to 1,900, and they include regular transfer, regular education, special education. They can include bilingual education, your gifted education, all the different types of programs that we run that are considered direct instruction. And when you get a little further in your board packet, you'll be able to see exactly what those expenditure functions are. We have our support services through 2000. Again, some of those are departments that I oversee, FFO, buildings and grounds. We have internal services, community services, other public school entities, and then our bonded interest payments. When we talk about object codes, we talked earlier just a moment ago about salaries, benefits, contract services, supplies, materials, and so forth. Those are all the areas that I have to utilize when identifying a particular expenditure within our budget. So our financial reports, as you know, the board sees a monthly financial report that's included in with your board packet. We also have to do quarterly reporting of grants, and then we have our annual claims for general state aid and transportation. And then we also have an annual audit, independent annual audit, and they provide us with the annual financial report, or AFR, and then our comprehensive annual financial report. Calendar of events and deadlines, as I spoke of earlier, we begin a budgeting process early on in the year. Right now, we're already starting to look at capital projects for the 2015 budget, and yet we're really just starting to talk to you about the 2014. Our philosophy of budgeting really is to budget to what are our necessary expenditures. The educational decision resources are made throughout our administrative team, including the building principals, and then cost centers and budget requests. They come from department heads and buildings. And then again, the board provides oversight and involvement. And as we move through the next couple of months, we'll be bringing you, as really part of the first step of next year's budget, will be capital projects, our recommendations for capital projects. So what do our revenues look like? 86% of our revenues are generated by local property taxes. The other 6% of local revenue are student fees, interest, and things of that nature. So that's where I came up with the figure of 92% of all of our revenues are locally generated. We do receive approximately 7% from the state, and then, as I said, only 1% from the federal government. This spreadsheet is a little, well, pretty difficult to see. As a matter of fact, I really can't see it up there. But it's a one-page document, and I will tell you that in total, our revenues are projected at $50,161,000 a year. This year, that includes all revenue from all sources, state, local, and federal sources. Our expenditures, so what do they look like? Rather typical for a school district when you're dealing with the education of children, and obviously the majority of our expenses are human capital. We spend 58 plus 11%. We spend almost 70% of our budget just strictly on salaries and benefits. And then the rest of the expenditures you can see up there, purchase services, supplies and materials, capital projects, and then other expenditures. This next page, what I did is I captured just a the expenditure side of your budget document is a three-page budget document. Not to bog down the presentation, I really only included the first page. The board, you have the actual budget document included with your packet. If you have any other questions on that, I'd be more than happy to answer them at any time. So, what we do annually is we prepare a comparison that shows the. As you know, we amended a budget last year, so we have total expenditures, revenue and expenditures for the 2012 and 13, which showed a deficit of $1.9 million, which was a result of having abated the bond and interest fund from the previous year. And we're showing this year a surplus of approximately $70,000. Overall, your revenues are going up for almost $4.3 million, again, as a result of having abated 2 years ago and increasing the revenues this year. Mm-hmm. Expenditures are going up almost $2.3 million. So this next slide shows a comparison. It shows that revenues overall are going up 9.31%. The majority of which is a result of the abatement from a couple of years ago. Property taxes are going up significantly. Our salaries are going up 4.51%. I did receive an email from a board member earlier this week or over the weekend questioning why that was going up. I will tell you that that number does include all board approved or about to be approved salary increases, salary positions, as well as the increases that were approved as a result of our last round of negotiations with our GIA staff. And as you know, we're still going through negotiations with our support staff. Dean?
So Bob, that line item is actually two things. It's increases in salary, but also increases in people.
It's increases in people, and I will also tell you that we backed out approximately $400,000 in retirements that were coming up this year also.
Okay.
As you can see, benefits, purchase services, and so forth, they totaled an increase of approximately 4.79%. This next spreadsheet really is a document, a page of a document that comes right off of the state budget reporting document. It has cash balances as of 6/30/2013. These are on a cash basis, not an accrual basis. And you'll notice the revenues tie out $50.1 million, expenditures of just over $50 million with a surplus of $70,000, with an undesignated fund balance of approximately $14.7 million. And then I've had board members, finance committee members, ask me previously, well, what is that? What are those numbers as a result, or what are they? What is a percentage? What do they represent as a percentage of operating expenditures? And here that comes up at about 25.4%. Real basically, or very quickly, revenues went up 9.31%. Real estate taxes, other local revenues, state revenues went up. I held state revenues at last year's level, except for just a slight increase of $25,000. But as we move through the months of June, July, and into early August, when I bring back the updated budget to you in August, I will make as many adjustments as I know them to be at that particular time. Federal revenues, I just held it at this year's level. Expenditures, we've already been through that. Expenditures, salaries, benefits, purchase services. So supplies and materials. These are all off of the spreadsheets that you've seen previously. I just wanted to highlight what are some of the capital expenditures that are going to be happening this year, and they also include the preventive maintenance, including that we do throughout our buildings annually, of which the majority of the work is done during the summer when we clean our buildings from wall to wall and from floor to ceiling. As you know, the Hadley LMC is going to be completely renovated. I was there today, and it is a shell of what it was just less than 2 or 3 weeks ago. We are also completely painting the interior of Hadley. It also includes continued technology updates, including the replacement of printers, services, servers, IMAX laptops, mini iPads, and iPads, and curriculum and continued classroom equipment standardization. Our plan for this year is to increase the number of 21st century classrooms to 32. I believe, Joe, you had a question on that earlier today. That will bring the total to 64 classrooms today. So the financial initiatives that we use, we build a five-year financial plan that ensures sustainability for the district for 5 years out. It includes program-based budget, which is aligned with the long-range plan. Everything we do is aligned with our long-range plan. Again, we are always trying to create and improve environments for our 21st century learners and create operational efficiencies through alignment with 21st century business practices. And then something that we've begun to move forward with is a one-to-one access for all students. And these are just some of the, you're looking for additional information that you might want to utilize, these are some of the sources that I utilize or that board members certainly can have available to them if they'd like to know anything about educational funding in the state of Illinois. So what's next? On June 24th, I'll bring you a recommendation where we're going to request your authority to post the tentative budget. That requirement is we are required to post that budget for 30 days. Typically, we post it, we get your authority on June 24th. We post it that following Thursday. It's posted here at CSO as well as our book buildings. And then on June 12th, we'll bring back a revised budget to the board for approval for action and approval. It is required that we post or that we approve our budget by the end of our first quarter, June 30th. So that's the process.
September.
Did I say June again? September. September 30th. Any questions?
Any questions from members at this time, keeping in mind that the budget is also one of our discussion items that appears later in the agenda? Any questions at this time? Okay. Thanks for now, Bob. Action items. Consent agenda. Are there any items board members would like removed from the consent agenda to be considered separately? Hearing none, may I have a motion to approve the reports and recommendations contained in the consent agenda, which includes human resources, personnel report, employment recommendations, administrative compensation, leaves of absences, and resignations, finance, facilities, and operations, which includes the Prevailing Wage Act, treasurer's appointment, other matters, approval of board meeting minutes for the May 28, 2013 regular meeting and the May 28, 2013 regular meeting closed session. May I have a motion?
Motion.
Motion by Mrs. Nelson, second by Mr. Ellis. Roll call, please, Mrs. Moe.
Mr. Penwood?
Yes.
Mr. Elder?
Yes.
Mr. Bochinski?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Escalante?
Yes.
Mr. Black?
Yes. Superintendent's recommendations. At its May 28th meeting, the board discussed the following recommendations. Reconsideration Committee's revised recommendation. The administration recommends the approval of the revised parent notification letter, attachment B, and the notification process, attachment A, for independent reading materials. May I have a motion to approve the administration's recommended as presented?
So moved.
Motion by Mrs. Nelson. May I have a second?
Yes.
Second by Mr. Ellis. Discussion. Who'd like to go first?
Sure. Well, this is the first time. I was just going to go first because I had made some edits to the letter. And as I said in my email, I'm not married to the words. They don't all have to be incorporated tonight if we approve it or not, but I just wanted to be able to provide some of the rationale that I thought was important to include in the letter.
John, before you get going,
yes,
does everyone have a copy of Mr. Kenwood's
letter?
I actually don't have it in front of me, but I can follow.
But you all received it.
Okay, sure. It's right here. We can share.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
For those of you guys that have it, I just thought it would be nice in the first sentence that we talk about what the goal of independent reading is, which is whatever it is to read 15 to 20 books or 20 to 25 books, but just to give an understanding that this is a goal that we're trying to accomplish through independent reading. This is in addition to what we do in literacy in the class and the book discussions that we have. I also thought it was important, and again, I'm not married to the words here, I also thought it was important that we explain what choice is and that it's a well-researched approach that gets students to read and to take more responsibility for their reading habits. So I thought that was part of the message of what we're trying to convey with choice and all the research that's behind choice. I did capitalize the "some with mature content," and I thought that that was, with all the emails we got, something that we want to highlight, not, bury in words or make it librarian speak as a
February.
And then I did add this concept, which I think is a part of the process, which is, if your child is reading something that they think is appropriate for them and then after beginning to read it feel differently, that the parents should encourage the child to discuss it with you, and if they still don't want to continue to read the book, they need to let the teacher know, and the teacher will work to find an alternative. I think that's a big part of the process that's not necessarily highlighted in the letter, and something that should be reinforced, that if I'm uncomfortable reading something, I should feel comfortable going to my teacher and saying that and ensuring that another book will be chosen for the independent reading. And then I probably said this incorrectly. The last concept I wanted to introduce was this process is much more robust in the sense that we're asking children to take something home, have it signed by their parents. We're presenting this letter. There's some, red font in here to get them to focus on some of the key words and things that will happen. But and it's going into Pinnacle. So we need the parents to understand that that this letter needs to be signed in order for the child to take advantage of the independent materials that are in the classroom. They can still go to the library and they can still check out books in the library if that's what they want to do with their independent reading. But if they want to take advantage of a teacher's book collection or something they have, then this letter needs to be signed. So I just thought that those were elements of the process that we've all discussed and just didn't feel they were in the letter. I'm not trying to rewrite the letter. I'm just trying to say here's what I think the committee should look incorporating these concepts, and that would make me feel more comfortable that the letter has enough information that parents can make these decisions.
So if I understand you correctly tonight, you're not asking to amend the recommendation by including your edits, but you're asking that the committee, some committee that you're referring to,
the literacy department, consider those edits.
Yeah, I would like. As we said in the last meeting, we want to make sure that this letter is clear and provides parents as much transparency as possible. So for me, I thought this was a way to do it. I'm not married to the words. I'd like the concepts to be in. You guys may read this and say, we don't need any of this, and vote how you want to vote, or you may say, we should amend the motion to include these words. To me, I'm okay knowing that this would go to the committee and that they would make this a part of the letter.
I think one of the things I would note is that none of the ideas that you have incorporated really are I'd say, more emphasis on the concepts that are already agreed to.
And that's really why I put them in there, because they were agreed to. I didn't think it would be a problem to specifically state, if I'm reading something, I'm not comfortable, I go to my parents, I go to the teacher, we find another book, and we move on. Right? So anyway, I don't know what your guys' thoughts are on that. I sent it to everybody, or Ann sent it to everybody.
Anybody have any comments on John's edits?
I guess I got a couple questions here, and it's going to help me with today's actions. Eric, and I think you brought it up at the last meeting. Independent reading is not required reading. It's choice reading. And it's choice reading that's logged by the students and is available to parents or guardians.
It's somewhat required, though.
For eighth grade students, they're required to read
X
number of independent reading books, but they log them and...
Yes.
And maintain their...
And they select them, right?
And they select them.
And when I refer to choice, that is the part of the research that suggests that, you know, there are some kids that just don't like to read, but then they choose a book that interests them, and then they start to read, and they like that topic, and then they want to read, you know, other books.
And that's the concept. I want to make sure that I understand that these are chosen books. These aren't required reading books. The program is required.
The independent reading is required
of 25 books. And my child has the opportunity to choose a library of independent reading material and resources to choose. And those resources are logged on a 25 log sheet
that
I, as a parent, am available to see. And is there any check for anything like that, that the parent has to check a box or something like that, or is it just the child's log?
Right. They're responsible for logging the book and identifying author, number of pages. There's a question about how they would rate the book, would they recommend it, what do they like about it. If they, whatever's the language, I guess, abandon the book, but if my son at the time in eighth grade didn't like a book, he would cross it out, and then I would ask him why. You know, so there's some interchange in terms of the log being a tool for some of that.
So what we have in front of us is the required signature by a parent at the beginning of the year, the trimester letter or letter three times a school year,
mm-hmm.
reminding the parents that their child is part of an independent study group curriculum. They have the option and choice to choose those materials, and they also have the option to choose not to read that material if they deem inappropriate for themselves or their parents to choose that. And they can select another piece of it.
They could also choose not to have their children select books from the classroom library if they chose to do so. There's that comment section at the bottom of the letter.
So they don't have to read the independent resources. They can choose another book.
They could choose from some other resource.
Which is that was the part of... That was the last comment that I didn't articulate too well, which was, you know, you don't have to take advantage of a private library, a teacher's library, you can select your own. But in order to take advantage of the private library, you need to sign the select. That's what I was trying to write in the last sentence.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Any other comments?
I was just going to say that I think with these edits, the letter goes a lot further than the original recommendation, and you know, provides what is necessary, I think, for parents to be a part of the process and ultimately the final decision making on what their kids read.
You know, I would agree that when I read your edits this afternoon, Jeff, and your suggestions, that it was more about emphasis and drawing out what we've been hearing both public participation over the last few meetings, but then also in the emails we've been getting for the last, you know, week or so. And then tonight, I think, supports some of what you're saying and what I want to offer as my thoughts on this, and that is there are at least, as I count them, 11 very specific comments by parents and speakers on both sides saying this is really about parent determination and parents having a voice and a very critical voice in terms of what their children are reading. And I think when I go back to the very beginning and look at our notes on this, that that was really the call at a very basic level for the parents who brought the book to the committee to have that conversation. So I feel like, and as I drew some notes up about this, that I wanted to reiterate, and you did that, Patrick, that this is a three times a year the letter is, you know, repeats itself if a parent has either read it and forgotten about it or life gets busy. You know, we understand that, but it is ultimately the parent's, you know, responsibility to be apprised and act. But I think the common ground in the discussion is really that strong desire for parents to have what I really heard, certainly tonight, but all the last couple weeks, ongoing communication with teachers to be able to set parameters for their child's reading choices. And that was heard explicitly to me tonight, whomever spoke, of the 25 people who spoke tonight on the issue, that it really is a parent and child communication. And in terms of the letter, and I don't disagree with some of the emphasis that you're suggesting, John, which doesn't preclude that letter from, you know, being a tweak. But that I do think it's, I think the letter is stronger. We directed Dr. Reebok 2 weeks ago to bring back revised language. She was able to do that with the assistance of the teachers and the reconsideration committee reviewing it. It does add specific examples of mature content, which for me, as I read them, would put up a red flag, certainly, and cause me to, you know, engage at a different level if I hadn't been already. So my desire in this as well is to recognize the insight on both sides of the conversation, and that is parents want to have and should have a very real communication that elicits a response from them where they can, with their child, identify what makes sense for them, and I think will create, you know, I know at least in my own family, a really good, solid conversation about literature, period, but also choice, so that then they can set those standards, parent with child, and the teacher being fully informed of those decisions. And for me, what's in the revised letter, with perhaps some more emphasis, but also the ability to make comment, to have teachers be more aware of that, more aware of that information, sets the tone moving forward for greater accountability on all sides. And I mentioned this at the last meeting, and that is we've talked a lot about parents wanting to have that voice and having more accountability as a part of the choice, and certainly teachers being fully informed and then following through on that and that responsibility in the classroom. But it's also up to the student to have accountability to following through with that as well, because they're intimately involved in this process. And I think that can only be a good thing for students to recognize their responsibility as well. So I support the reconsideration committee recommendation at this point, what we have in front of us, with one reminder, and that is I, along with board members, have talked about this as well, and we do recognize that current policy needs to be reviewed by the policy committee. It needs to be brought back to the full board, and this is board's work as a governing body, and so that will be important for us to do this summer.
Anyone else? Any comments?
This is, it's rather fitting tonight. If Maurice Sendak was still alive, he would have been 85, and he's the guy who wrote this book. And if anybody has kids, you're probably nodding. And it's Where the Wild Things Are. And not surprisingly, when the book came out, which was in the late 60s, I think, it was very contentious. When it came out, a lot of southern schools banned the book, a lot of libraries banned the book, and they thought that it wasn't good that they were glorifying that this young child was having a tantrum and they hadn't addressed it. They also thought, there was a psychologist who was quoted as saying that they thought that it was damaging for 3 and 4 year olds to be told that it was an inappropriate form of punishment that would traumatize young readers, and thought the idea of the mother would deprive the child of food, because if you remember, the beginning of the book starts by sending the child to bed without food. If the person would have read to the end of the book, they would have found out that the parents brought the food to the child at the end. which is why it's important to read the whole book and not take excerpts of a book out. And so I was not on the board when we made the last vote, but I was in the audience. And when the vote came out, the board rejected the recommendation, I think for the reasons that people are talking tonight, that the procedure was a little bit vague. And part of that, we were left with the idea of, well, you know, now what do you do? And at the time, I think it was stated that we're going to take the book out. So I want to make sure that we understand tonight when we vote that we need to clear that up, because I think it's important, and that's why so many people are showing up here, that if we vote no, then the book stays out, and if we vote yes, then I understand the book's going to come back in. And I will tell you that everybody on this board received well over 500 emails around this topic. And I also know that we read them because we talked about them. So we've read all 500 emails. I've read the book now twice. I've watched the movie. I've talked about it. I've had people from the community coming up to me and talking to me about it. I have 3 kids. Yes, they read the book. Yes, I was okay with them reading the book. And I will tell you that everybody here takes this very seriously and wants to make sure they were doing it from a very informed position, and then as we go forward, we come out with this. And I would echo what some of the folks have said, because the one part that comes through this the most is being able to make sure that the parents have a say in what's going on. I think we can all agree that, you know, we heard both sides. It isn't going to be appropriate for everybody, and the person who might know that is the parent. And so giving the parent the vehicle to do this solves kind of both issues. I think it allows them to decide for their child what the reading will be, but not for everyone's child. And I think it also, just as importantly, recognizes that the decision about personal libraries in the classroom still resides with the teachers. And that's just as important, I think, to understand that.
Thanks. Anyone else?
I'll add a few words. I'm like Dean. I started out when this issue started out, we were sitting in the suits and trying to understand everything. We probably didn't get all the emails, and I didn't get all the emails and all the information you guys received. But since that time, as Dean said, we've received well over, if my count was 350, my appointment's close enough. We received a lot of emails. I'm sure you got them. I bet you got them counted. Yeah. And they're from across the world. People from Australia reached out to us. Former board members reached out to us, both in emails and in verbal comments in the public comment section. And I want to thank all the parents and teachers that got up and spoke. It's important for us to hear that. I was a bit overwhelmed how many students got up and spoke. And I think it really is a testament to the district and to what we're trying to do here. Students illustrated just outstanding constructive thought on what is a very sensitive issue, and it's that's not easy to do, to get up and speak in public about a sensitive issue. And it really did illustrate to me, at least, and I think to many others, that the district's learning characteristics are working, and overall I'm just proud to be part of the district, and I'm proud of the district, and I'm proud of the kids. I think it's just a great testament. I did read the book. At the highest level, it's not about a book. It's about every book in the Hadley classroom libraries. I think that's important. We've heard people speak of other books. I brought up the Slippery Slope last time, and that's why it's not about one book. At the end of the day, I believe that the public school libraries, the classroom libraries, the responsibility that we need all students need, not just one. Not easy to do, but I think what we're putting in place helps us to do that. So I think that's it's tough to accommodate everybody's needs, their interests, their abilities, and all that. And that's what the classroom library does. And if we have what appears to be, with John's edits, a good letter going out and explaining everything in detail, as much detail as possible, is always good. I think that's great. Overall, I think at the end, what we're doing, and I strongly support choice by parents, and I think that's very important. We're trying to offer to the parents the ability to have a choice and even to opt out. I think it's important that if someone opts out, that we're not isolating the student, and I think that needs to be part of the theme throughout the literacy classes. I will see, it was at Ben Franklin who had a public speaker get up, and I thought he put it succinctly. It was Mr. DeFabio, if I have that right, who talked about having trust in the administrators and the teachers, having trust in the parents, and at the end, having trust in the students. So I think that sums it up the best. I believe that what we're doing in this proposal is meaning everything that a compromise report I heard. I think that's what we're attempting to do. I do think as we get feedback through the year, when this letter goes out, that we should listen to that feedback. Mm-hmm. And if it ultimately needs to be edited again, then I think the administration should go ahead and do that within certain bounds. So, that's my summary. What is a very enlightening issue for me to be going over.
Thank you. Someone else, Mr. Ellis.
You know, I'd like to just frame everything and kind of wrap it up. In the original board action was based on recommendation to the reconsideration committee, who was charged with originally responding to a parent's concern over a specific book. The board's original decision, in my opinion, it was that the first recommendation was not explicit enough in regarding the selection of independent reading. The board encouraged the committee to resubmit a recommendation with strengthened parental verbiage in the letter. I think this was goal of the entire board that we address the concern of access to a potentially provocative creative material. I was challenged to read this book, which I did. But regardless of my opinion as to the creative material, I'm not qualified to determine age appropriateness. I would argue that none of us on this board are qualified to determine age appropriateness. I think the parents, their respective children, working with their teachers are only suited to answer this query. I do remain an advocate of parental rights, including parental consent, but I welcome all the concerned parties in terms of seeing that parents have the opportunity to approve access to this book for their children. Protecting the children within the district is our first goal. And as such, parents must provide consent permitting access to potentially provocative, creative material. The district must meet children at each individual child's level. Parental consent addressed. The parental consent is addressed in the revised letter. And is represented through the reconsideration committee. Those concerns, I believe, have been addressed. I am in ready to move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. Anyone else? Mr. Kendrick? Mr. Escalante?
Yeah, I guess, you know, again, I think Joe said, and I think as administrators in a school board, our job is not to be teachers. Our job is to try to write policies and procedures. I think this one needs to be worked on, but we need to move forward. As much as it is the parents' right and concern to approve books, it is also my right as a parent to not approve that book. And I want to have that same respect for my kids if I decide not to choose a book. We've gone past the incidents that may or may not happen in the school, but I would hope this administration deals with those things honestly and confront them immediately, because the last thing I want to hear is my son or daughter coming home and say, I chose not to read this book, and my once friends are now bullying me. As a parent, I will step up. As a teacher, I want you to step up. And I want you to protect the rights of my kids. So, as much as it is for approval, I want the same respect for non-approval of them. That's all I have.
Yeah, and I think that's largely why I embedded some of those concepts in the letter, to reinforce that not approval means not approval. I was fortunate enough to miss the first vote. I was out on business. I'd like to think if I were here, things would have been different in terms of how this would have handled. But I feel that we've taken the community through a lot in this process. And in some respects, you know, I feel that we do owe you an apology for the process that was taken, that led us to where we are today, the amount of time that we spent on this, the time it's taken away from, you know, the administration, your families, the school. You know, we've got other issues facing us like facilities and think tank implementation. So I'm not sure the process was the best process, and I hope that we learn from that. So at least from my perspective, I apologize for that. I know not all the board members read the book. I don't know if they should have or shouldn't have, but, you know, I felt they were voting on something and it was important. Obviously, two board members came out afterwards and said they weren't sure what they were voting on. If they had known what they were voting on, they may have changed. I do agree with your comments that enforcement of this by the teachers is going to make or break this. I do feel we've heard some stories about maybe the teachers well-intentioned and trying to advocate some of the learner characteristics that we have in our district. But, you know, I do also feel that maybe in some situations there was some poor judgment around how that support occurred. So bullying should not be tolerated. I'm not saying that we did tolerate it, but clearly that's one of the outcomes that came out of this process, is a child got bullied. So that's, again, why I feel a need to apologize. And at the end of the day, there is a child who got a book that was inappropriate for them. And that's not right. So, again, apologies for that. Like anything that happens that's, you know, not a well-oiled machine, there's learnings that came out of this. And for me, the first one is just the students that came to speak, regardless of what their position was. You guys were concise, not like us here who pontificate forever. You were respectful of the process. You spoke from the heart. The young lady tonight that spoke, that was very hard to speak and started crying. You know, I don't know if she's still here, but whoever her parents are, that's quite a young lady. And, you know, that is just... that's what we expect of kids, that they speak their minds and be able to help each other. And I'm hoping that out of this process that we all, you know, not bully each other, but go support each other. Something's happened. You know, it's kind of like the end of a series at a hockey game. You shake each other's hands, you look each other in the eye, and you move on. And I hope that's what happens here. I do feel there were some other benefits. I think we've gotten a greater awareness and involvement by parents in terms of what books are written for children today, and what's out there. So I think that was helpful. We've made a commitment to the community that we will update our policy this summer, and I believe we've improved the process and become more transparent. I think the letter is a significant improvement in transparency than what we had before, and better information. And I think we've also provided some tools that parents can use to go look at websites and determine, you know, what may or may not be appropriate. Because as a parent, it's hard to read everything. So I personally still feel that we should have a committee next year that would look at how we incorporate technology, maybe to provide further transparency in terms of what's available, what's not available. Not something that can be done overnight. Maybe it's a grandfathered approach, but I think that we need to think about technology and how we can use it. So at the end of the day, I don't feel the role of the board is to determine what's appropriate or not appropriate. Mr. Ellis said it. I'm not trained or qualified to tell you what is or isn't for your child. I had one clergyman say, read it. I had another clergyman say, don't read it. I had one parent said, read it. Another parent said, don't read it. I had a child say, read it. Another child said, don't read it. I can't tell you. I'm not qualified to do that. So I feel I can only speak for what's appropriate for my child. And the board, in my opinion, here is here to ensure there's a robust process that allows that to happen, ensures the policies reflect the mission of the district, and that process should provide what is appropriate for the child to read, and should include the parents, the trained professionals, for that approval. So I think Erica said it, and Erica said it, and all the emails we got, there was one common theme, whether you're for it or against it. Parents have a right to decide. Parents are the ultimate ones that need to be able to make the decision. The young man up here spoke about a compromise. The young woman up here spoke about a compromise to make sure that we do have parent input, and that's what this process that we're moving forward is all about. So that's my comment. You got an hour. You got 3 minutes.
Thanks, Mr. Kenwood. I just have a couple of brief things to say. I guess I took the wrong week to go on vacation. I did read all the hundreds of emails that were sent, and it was admittedly very difficult for me to do, but I did it. And I found one that I think reflects my views the most, and I'm just going to read it. Is Beth Loretto here tonight? I'm just going to read it out loud. I am asking you to stand your ground as a school board. Let the parents, the teachers teach, and the school board govern. Without anyone concerned about the bullying of a personal decision, we are all given the freedom to make a personal decision, and we should not be concerned that we will be attacked for that decision. I'm writing in support of your recent decision to remove a controversial book from the 8th grade reading list. It seems as though a few sensitive teachers misunderstood your decision. The book that is removed from a reading list is not banned. The book is simply removed from the list to use for the curriculum. This happens all the time. Some books are included on the reading list, and other books are rejected. For a number of reasons, not all are controversial. As an educator myself, this is Ms. Loretto, not me, I understand the specific criteria need to be met in order for a book to be selected or omitted from the curriculum. There's a wealth of reading materials available that would offer plenty of learning opportunities for students. Why would teachers feel that this book would be the best they could offer to their students? It's time the professional educators stand above the mediocrity that is offered every day through media that these children are exposed to. It's time to demand higher standards for our children, not to lower the standards to what some people deem as age-appropriate. Of all people, junior high teachers are well aware of the enormous amounts of changes that occur within this age group. Teens' bodies and brains are developing at different times. Why would a group of teachers believe that they have the authority to determine that a book is age-appropriate for that diverse group of students? There's enough to deal with in the public schools these days. First and foremost, bullying and the physical, emotional, and social safety of these students. I don't understand why teachers would want to take on this controversy when there are so many more important issues to deal with. Let the parents deem what is appropriate for their child, i.e. their maturity level. Select good quality literature that is appropriate for the social and emotional development of all students. If parents want their 14-year-old to read about bestiality, let the students check it out at the public library. That sums it up for me, and I think I'm on the opposite end from a lot of members here tonight, but I will agree that the changes that have been made and the recommendations that have been presented for us, the letters home and the art of reading a book, to me, those are great first steps to solving this problem and making this issue palatable to both sides of this argument. But I don't think it's enough, and I'm encouraged to hear other board members think that we have to deal with policy issues, and I'm also encouraged that other board members are thinking that if necessary, and most likely necessary, Mr. Kenwood's edits specifically could at some point be incorporated in these letters, if appropriate. So, with that, Mrs. Moe, will you please call the vote?
Wait, before we call the vote, I want to make sure that we know exactly what we're voting on.
Well, Mr. Elder, I think we're voting on the motion to approve the revised parent notification letter, the notification process for independent reading materials. I think that would, if this motion passes, it would be my understanding that any book in the entire world could be recommended by a teacher,
okay,
with the certain provisions that we have done here.
So the book would be not any book. It'd have to be a book that's legally allowed to be.
Right.
Not any book.
I stand corrected.
I mean, there needs to be, it's a legal book, and we still have a literacy committee that reviews and discusses, and, right? And there's a process in place, not anyone.
Well, there's no...
Oh, that should be clear about that.
For independent reading, personal libraries and teachers' classrooms do not go through the literacy committee. Curriculum goes through the literacy committee. So I just want to make that distinction.
Well, we have teachers that are supposed to be...
Making judgments, professional
judgments. Making judgment, and...
Right.
You know, they're not going out.
I think the question is more specific to, with the reinstatement of this process, you go back to square one, which was if this process of notification to parents is to your satisfaction, that the books that parents have the responsibility and the right to help their children select independent reading books, that books can be on the library shelf, and then this book in particular will be restored to the libraries.
Okay. All right.
Classroom libraries.
Okay,
just one more comment before we vote. Very divisive issue here tonight. Regardless of the outcome, let's respect each other's decisions and the outcome and the reactions of the group. I hope would be, in my, professional and respectful, and we move forward as a community.
Great advice.
Sam, one more.
Mr. Ellis,
in terms of after the vote, when was it drawn? Is there something in the motion that will prompt the policy committee to look at that issue of supplementary reading material that's absent from the current policy?
It's not in the motion, but it's been in the recommendation that's in the board report, and I think you have the consensus of the board.
It will go to policy.
I think that's been approved.
I want to make sure when will you draw it?
True, I can say with certainty that as the chairman of the policy committee,
it's going
this
to
issue will go to policy.
Yeah, I think we're all voting under the expectation that it will go to policy, and
the
before school starts, we will have a policy in place.
That may be ambitious.
Well, we'll see about that.
Yeah.
It'll definitely go to policy.
We would hope that our policy committee members would get it done.
Yeah. We would hope so. Anything else on this issue? Mrs. Moe, roll call, please.
Mr. Escalante?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Elder?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Bochinski?
Yes.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Mr. Black?
No. Motion carries. So we're contemplating taking a 5-minute break. Excuse me. We're going to take a 5-minute break to let those who wish to not stay for the remainder of the meeting a chance to leave. So thank you all for coming. If you wish to stay, by all means stay. But if not, have a good evening. We'll resume at 10 p.m. Okay, back to the superintendent's recommendation. Approval of assistant principals at Forest Glen and Abraham Lincoln. The administration recommends that the board approve the employment of Megan Kuzora as assistant principal at Forest Glen Elementary School at an annual salary of $80,000 and Darlene Stone as assistant principal at Lincoln Elementary School at an annual salary of $89,000. May I have a motion to approve the administration's recommendation as presented?
Motion.
Motion by Mr. Alger.
Second.
Second by Mrs. Nelson. Mm-hmm. Discussion.
I know there's been a lot of conversation about this, and I know there's been a lot of previous conversations in the prior board, so I got to trust that a lot of this stuff was vetted out. Personally, I'm still not comfortable with the reasonings, and again, my role as a school board member is not to regurgitate every meeting that's happened over the last 8 months about assistant principals and such. But there was a step that was taken to remove the assistant principals, and the reason was decided upon, and we wanted to do that. Percy, I don't know what the evidence is to substantiate that we still need the assistant principals. I think there's a lot of stuff that's still going on. Core, STEAM, STEM 21, all of those things. I personally think this is one of those things that I don't think there would be a lot of harm in maybe delaying this conversation, at least in here. A lot of issues and a lot of, like you said, regulations are coming down the pipe. Let's see what's in front of us before we have to, you know, put two new posts out here that maybe we can pause for one year. That's just how I feel. I just don't know if I have all the information to make a valid decision. But with the information I have right now, that's kind of where I stand.
So I'd like to add to some of what Patrick said, because I feel like I'm a little late in the game on this, and I know what my gut tells me and I know what my head tells me. It's two different things. I've been trying to do a lot of due diligence on this matter. I've sent a lot of emails to him, which has answered a lot of them. I've started to be comfortable that I understand and inform fully. I want to be 100% on. Maybe I need to be 99%. I'm 100% guy, though. So I did get a better feeling of the special ed at each school, and that really helped me start getting an understanding that we are taking a very, what I would call in my world, a business-like approach to where we need our resources and how there's some equal needs in school based on how we're doing pre-K, early childhood pre-K at Forest Glen, and all that. That's just one example. I won't go through all the examples. But I'm still with you on this, Patrick, where I'm not 100% there, and I'm really close, and I know it's partly because maybe I didn't have the history that everyone else has, or I just didn't do enough due diligence. So that's kind of where I'm at on the issue. Delaying it a year, it's probably a good recommendation from my vantage point. I'm on the fence. It's something in my head and gut don't agree. It's not all that often, but it does happen. So I just wanted to express those thoughts here tonight. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anyone else?
I was going to say, one of the advantages of having new board members is a new perspective, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's good. What I think I'm hearing from you is the information you need to make this decision, whether it's yes or no, you don't have at this point. And I'm hearing you guys haven't gotten to see everything you need to see to say yes or no, and that's probably what's making you lean more no until you feel more comfortable. Is that
a fair statement?
I've gotten a lot of information over the last three weeks. So I'm really, I'm taking it all in because a lot of it's new. And I'm doing hours, I'm multiplying things out so I can understand it. Some of it I don't know all the mandates, that are coming down the pike or that have come down the pike. I'm trying to visualize the best I can, evaluations and what goes into it. I know I do evaluations at work and it's very time consuming. But, and I don't do classroom evaluations, so that adds to it. So I'm wrestling with it. Trying to understand all the special ed needs of the district. I think I have a better education of that. That has gotten me very close to it, that education. So is there something else out there that gets me over the top? There probably is, John. I don't know what that is, but I'm still learning.
Yeah, and I'm not advocating to get you over the top.
No,
yes,
I understand.
I'm just saying to have the right information. And maybe what I'm asking Ann is there, what's... Obviously, we would like everyone to have the information they need to vote, but we also have a responsibility to keep the system moving, right? So what is the implication of, and maybe the other board members will feel it, I'm not trying to jump in here, but what's the implication of giving more time so people can get whatever information they think they need?
Lots of candidates that we've made tentative offers to. Starting the process.
And so what does that mean? Both of these are not in our system?
No. One position is a position that already exists. So that's, that would be a reduction. The other position is a position that the board directed me to move forward on.
So just
the prior board, to be fair.
The prior board.
Yeah. So just again, in interest of information here, is if we divide these up into two groups, the position that already exists that we need to fill?
Well, remember we've done a reassignment, a redesign. So we have three positions currently approved. I would say four positions approved by the board. We have three that are already in existence with a vacancy that needs to be filled. And in terms of, Joe's conversation, we've had, several conversations. I think we spoke at length on Sunday to review some of his questions. And, we're happy to answer any questions. We don't have, when you say, can you tell me what every minute of the day of an administrator is consumed with, take this last issue that the board just voted on, which has consumed my time, weeks of my time. So I don't know how I'd quantify that for you. That's one of the dilemmas of working in a school system where, as I said to Joe, that a teacher, an administrator comes in, has a meeting in the morning, scheduled meeting, has maybe an observation conference scheduled with a teacher, has a pre-observation conference scheduled with a teacher, has three parent phone calls that have come in since 7:30. We have a child that now has a... The day is not predictable. It's not where you can sit and say, here's what I'm going to do, and I can pretty much follow my schedule on a daily basis. So to quantify the rhythm of a day is probably the most difficult thing.
There are clearly defined responsibilities around special ed, class evaluation.
Right, and I tried to get that background to all board members.
And it was mentioned earlier about other schools this size and assistant principals. I think
it varies from school district to school district.
Yeah, I think we have seen schools that have some, others that don't, and it's based on their needs.
Mm-hmm. Often, as I said, it's often based on maybe the size of the school, maybe based on the needs of the school, maybe based on the needs of the community. I also want to reiterate that when we eliminated these positions, we did so under board opposition back in 2010. And we did so not with the intention that we didn't need these positions, but that as we looked at trying to, at that time, make sure we had made accommodations for any potential reductions from the state that we couldn't anticipate at that time, and to be in a good place to weather that should there be a need to do so. We have not reinstated those positions or requested to have those reinstated due to the fact that we couldn't afford them. We didn't have them reinstated because, as I told the board at that time, we would wait to see what 3 years brings in terms of observing and looking at what is not, is in terms of that workload. And so we've waited every year. I think the question was raised to me, are we going to bring them back, whether it was raised by a group or whether it was raised by the board. And we said we still need to see what's the impact that we've experienced, and we feel the impact has been. Not that people aren't working harder. People are working harder all the time. And I think that's, certainly an assumption that doesn't have merit in the day-to-day work of our administrative team. But with the increased para, so the it's not mandates that are coming down the pike. It's mandates that we've had for the past several years that are bearing down on us, and para is one of them, one of many. Common Core is an instructional mode that, yes, we know that's going to increase leadership time, but it's the mandates that are associated with the RTI process and are associated with evaluation.
And the in terms of, help me understand, the district has already made offers.
Tentative offers, pending board approval.
Okay.
That's a normal process.
Okay. So we, theoretically, we have an out. If the board
votes. If the board votes no, then there's no positions to offer.
Okay.
That would be, that's not good for our reputation, but
right.
That's
right. It makes it's not an optimal situation. The question about comparable districts, is there some information that in terms of assistant principals at our comparable districts
that I can tell you right now?
That you could provide us with us at the next meeting?
If that means the board won't be taking action at this meeting, then we can do whatever the board asks us to do.
Well, I'm not. I'm saying one way or the other.
Sure.
I think that's something information, because I think that would be good information for all board members.
Sure, we can always ask.
To look at comparable or similar type districts, and what's going on with that.
Sure.
My assumption is that it's similar to what we're doing, and all we're trying to do is get us back to where we were before, which is similar to other districts. But I don't know that, and I know that solely from an intuitive standpoint. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, that's something I think that would be valuable for me. I think some of the other board members would find that useful.
Anyone else?
Just really briefly, Ann had sent, in our board document some data that I think Lori had pulled together, thank you, Lori, on the breakdown of the minutes of observation, the hours that turned into, so that collection of data, which I think for me was helpful from a structure standpoint, because I know that when PARA was passed by the state legislature, one of the first conversations that the previous board had was around that very question. So how does this now impact principals and their role within the school as building leader, meaning, this adding X number of minutes or hours, to their day in terms of the rent of observation, and that it's critical that this be done, by the book, because of the new structure around how teachers are evaluated in that four-level rubric, because then their evaluation does impact their longevity in the district to some level. I mean, one of the things that Pera did was pull back on the expectation of tenure, right? So we know that the observations are absolutely critical to a valid evaluation in order for us, to keep the best and the brightest and to be accurate in what we do. So that question came up. I was one of those board members when Ann came to the board and said, here's a position control approach that we're doing, that asked the question, so what will this do to principals and the kind of workload? And one of my, personal, interests as a building principal is that they don't spend 90% of their day sitting in their office. They're a building leader. We have our last enrollment report, the one that came in today. The smallest school we have is 575 children at Ben Franklin, 598, 596, 653 at Churchill, and 1,200 student plus a junior high that we got dinged on in the conversations around facilities for being, completely, too large, for a junior high. So we know that, in these past conversations dating back to, we're going to reduce this because we want to be fiscally conservative, as we have no idea what the state legislature was going to do, and those are really very, rocky times for the board and concerns that Bob and Ann brought to the table. But we bit the bullet and we did it because we wanted to be really conscientious about that. And I don't regret that, but at the time I do remember saying, and other board members at the time saying, we want to revisit it. We want a progress report. We want to know if things are falling through the cracks, particularly special education, which has become much more complex at every grade level. And so that's from a programmatic standpoint, and our kids at all levels, public education, you open that door, every child that comes through gets an education. And that means really differentiated expectations. So I have always had concerns in terms of kind of the progress monitoring around this on whether or not we've been able to keep up with it. So, Ann, if you went to cabinet and said, what will this new next year bring if we don't put the position in CSO back into an assistant principal position, if we keep it the way it is? What will this year bring, knowing what we have on our plate and with our move toward fulfilling the long-range plan of 21st century learning, and you don't, these assistant principal positions are not available? What might the principal say? What would their response be, in all honesty?
Well, they're going to feel somewhat desperate, as they felt this year. And, we're also looking at the implementation monitoring of a new educational paradigm, which mm-hmm. is going to require an all-hands-on-deck. But they would say that it will be very difficult for them to fulfill other obligations because they're going to have to put first attention to the RTI process mm-hmm. and evaluations, because those are state mandates mm-hmm. and federal mandates. So that yes. there are other things that will, leadership pieces that will have to fall through the cracks and be left up. Communication will diminish, I think. But we'll have to take care of, those are the things that will have to be taken care of.
Mm-hmm. And just so to be clear on the facts of what we're voting on a one-year contract.
Correct.
We're not voting on a commitment for assistant principals for the next 5 years.
No.
This is a
voting on a one-year contract.
One-year contract.
All administrators are one-year contracts.
My biggest concern really is at Churchill, and we know because we got this statistic just recently, and that we're at. And I just heard the other day when we were at CIT actually that we're at 48%. Correct me if I'm wrong. Free and reduced. Children and their students are free and reduced lunch, right? Mm-hmm. So that's 48% of a school of 653 students. It's that high.
48? I thought it was 40.
I thought 48% it was over 40.
It was over 40. I heard from...
It wasn't... The threshold was...
40% was the threshold.
The threshold was 40%.
The practice program, we were at 48%.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry.
No, that's right. Good clarification, Kim. So, I hear that number, and I think we all know that part of what that also represents are children, students that also bring some other real risk factors, which causes, you know, a different dimension of focus and need. So, you know, I that number really struck me the other day. We just had CIT on Friday. And, you know, it says more than now we need to provide breakfast because we hit the threshold and we need to provide lunch, which we do, but also all these other pieces in a district that should never, ever suggest that it doesn't pursue excellence, because we know that it does and it will continue to do, because that's our common cause, certainly as a board, to move that forward as our long-range plan. But that's just a number that blew me away, and it has a lot of implication around it. So I Patrick and I have talked about this, and Joe and I absolutely respect your questions, because I know when I came on the board, I had a similar vote that I had to make relatively early on. And there's a dearth of background, you know, that you don't have bringing into the conversation. So I respect you putting it on the table. I wanted to, you know, to recognize that, you know, some of our very small district is really a very diverse district needing, you know, very, very different things depending on the school. So that's my concern in terms of, you know, this one-year appointment.
Yeah, I'm not sure the statistic of 40 or 48% matters. I mean, I don't really know that I understand the correlation, but...
Well, what I'm trying to say is that when we know that we have a population of students that qualify by state, by federal law, for free and reduced lunch, that they're demographically and by experience in this district and others around us, we know that they bring additional support needs as well in terms of learning
time. High risk factors require more time.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that for the 6 years I've sat on the board.
Well, I guess for me, I don't know what that translates to, but I worry that the special education program has the right amount of attention in the building.
And that's been an assistant principal.
Right. I mean, in the history of that, that's a large reason why assistant principals were brought in.
Other districts may not have an assistant principal, may have a special education supervisor in the staff, someone
right.
that...
So, for me, that's part of the program that I don't want to shortchange. Mm-hmm. And with some of the new rules being passed around evaluations and the ability to use evaluations more like we would in the business world, I think that's important. Mm-hmm.
It's a changed paradigm, for sure.
You know, I don't want to get into the merits of how important these things are, but, you know, again, being the naive guy, everything can't be important in our budget. Can we do a net-net somehow? Can some, whatever the total, if it's a one-year contract, can we defer some other program, some other school supply in budget 1,000 or whatever it is that this is going to fall in?
Well, we're
to increase our fund balance then as a result.
No,
not to
increase, but just to net-net. We're not going to do zero game. We're not going to do this because we want to bring assistant principals in.
But we did budget for them.
I know, okay. We budgeted for them,
okay,
but
so
let's not always say we budgeted for them.
But our budget's off now anyways, right? The one that was presented, because we have less state funding. We're plus 70, right? If I understood that. It's going to be a further discussion.
So well,
we're always making adjustments
yeah.
to the budget. I mean, that's what Bob said. He's always moving things here and there.
But we don't have any indicator right now specifically from the state what our lack of
just
adjustment would be.
Just an email that's given us a
90%
pro rata, which is $130,000. So.
I mean, to your point, we could do what we we could save the administration, yes, but take 200,000 out or 100, whatever. I mean, we can do that. That's something we can do. We can save the administration. We can approve the principles, but let's take 180K out somewhere.
Like you said, it's a one-year contract. And
what's the process? When do we take a wee look at this? I mean, is that normal, or do
we look at what
these positions? I mean, when you get your,
We bring a recommendation back to each year for positions. We don't bring back necessarily, though. There's nothing to preclude it. We bring you our staffing report and ask you to take action on that.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Which makes sense. Just make sure I'm clear on the process.
And there's also the conundrum of budget versus levy and the timing and when you're getting money, and that adds a unfortunate non-real world aspect to it that is baffling.
Well, really, it's really a guess factor, I would imagine, because the levy process is in December, the budget process is in June. Yeah. So it's to commend Bob that he's gotten so close, because sometimes it's very, very difficult to get that close. So to try to change it now would be a little difficult, I would suggest.
It shouldn't be hard to take 180K out of 50
million. Right. I mean, we want to make sure it's out of the right place.
That's clearly true.
I mean, what we're saying is we're prioritizing.
Right.
Like that's what we're doing. We try to prioritize. And from the sounds of this, this is a very high priority. And I'm just trying to educate myself that it is that high. And I can still get the feeling of this from all the discussion, from all the questions that I asked and the different answers I got. So,
I have a question. Were we to do that? Were we to say we want to take 180,000 out of the budget if we're going to do the assistant principal? What's the effect to you and your staff?
Well, we need to go. We'll go back and look at the budget. We did the same thing when we talked about student fees. We'll go back. We'd have to go back and look at the budget and see where we would take it.
Are we at one though, position?
Not one.
Not one. So it's not 180.
Right. We're replacing a position.
So we're actually talking
about.
Talking I like this idea better because now we're only looking at to be neutral, whatever it is, 80,000 plus benefits.
So cost control is
90.
Whatever the number is.
Well, for me, when this topic originally came up, I had trouble with it myself, but given the information that was presented, given the these evaluations are lengthy things to do, the para evaluation, the Common Core standards are here and they're coming, and they're not going to go away, so we're going to need more staff to be able to implement those. The RTIs are very cumbersome. And obviously our student population is more than it should be. But what really sold it for me was teachers that I spoke to, that I continue to speak to. I'm in the schools every day because that's my job as a stay-at-home parent. And the funny thing is that the teachers that I speak to, they all say the same thing. And I wasn't on the board when the original decision was made to reduce the assistant principals, but every one of them, and I'm not making this up, every one of them said, what are you guys doing getting rid of the assistant principals? We don't care about iPads. We don't care. They're making a prioritization themselves and saying, you can have your iPads. You can have your computers. We want assistant principals. We want staff to aid in the classrooms to help us. So for me, that's all for me. When you combine the fact that these federal and state mandated programs are here. There's nothing we can do about it. They're here. And the fact that the teachers really feel as though that they need it to do their jobs correctly. Another thing, I think Erica said that
We don't want our principals in their offices all day, every day, bogged down by evaluations and other processes. At least I don't. I want my principal to be walking the hallways, going into a classroom, helping out, you know, maybe teaching a lesson or maybe adding to the lesson, going onto the playground. Not hundreds of things, but numerous other things to do other than to have to do these things that are federally and state required. So for me, that's all that at this point. And we are, in fact, only adding one position at this point based on, you know, our re-budget.
Reassigning.
Thank you. From central services out to the schools. So, I'm all for this.
It's prioritization conversation. Teachers want it. Everybody wants it. Let's make it a high priority. Let's just make it cost neutral.
Well.
I think you should vote on the recommendation that's before you. You can direct us back to take $90,000 from some other expenditure line or lines. Most likely it would be several.
Do we amend the motion to do that?
Procedurally, if
I don't think you need to.
You can just give that to us. Gotcha.
So we'd be voting on approving the principals with the idea that we would find $90,000 in our budget to take out. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm hearing.
That's what we're sort of hearing, but I don't know if I would want to mix those together. I think if we want to give the administration that direction, I think then we would have to amend this recommendation to state that specifically. And if we get an amendment with a second and approval on the amendment, then I think we go that way. But I personally don't think that's the way to go. But if we have anyone who feels as though that is the way to go, an amendment can be introduced, and we can go from there. But I suggest that we vote on this recommendation.
Take a vote on this motion.
Yeah, I agree. Because the board, to your comment, Patrick, the board absolutely in with the superintendent as our direct report has the ability to sit down and hash out those issues. And we're in the budget process again, so it's a perfect time to have that conversation. I think we need to amend the.
Here's what I would add to the priority discussion. I think we're going to do this sometime this summer. Is that we need to sit down and have a workshop to talk about priorities. What is important, right? Because right now we could say this is a priority, vote on it, and say we'll take $90,000 out. But then we all get together and realize we haven't had that priority discussion. And that's a little bit of what's backwards around the way the state of Illinois works the budgeting and the levy and these votes and when you need to do it, when contracts need to be assigned. But I've always been a big proponent of priorities, and those priorities drive what we're doing, and they drive where dollars go, and you can't do everything.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, we have long-range plans, and long-range plans are long-range plans and strategic, but there's always, after the 10,000-foot level, you go down to 5,000 level, and you say, okay, let's take a look at that, and then we're done, because as administrative staff, we don't, like we tried once before, we don't get in the weeds, but you got long-term goals, and then let's just...
Maybe the thinking here is you either decide whether this is a priority based on what you've heard, and then but knowing that when we get together and we discuss priorities, that usually there's a budget that follows the priorities, and we can at any time come back to the administration and say, take $1 million out of the budget.
Well, we directed the administration to abate almost $3 million.
Right.
We did the opposite.
Right. I just with, like everybody, we've all heard it tonight, the finance process and the budgeting and the tax levy. It's a very kludgy process, and I think in that uncertain environment, we have a diligence to make sure that we add some fences, some milestones that we get to that says, okay, it is a very messy process, it's very unclear, but we promised ourselves that superintendent, net zero is 90,000, and we've got to hold ourselves to that. I just, if we're not going to say the motion is, this is, you know, and then we remove it, and we just say the assistant principals, we got to have good administrative prudence to make sure 90,000 comes out as a net change, because if we don't, we start losing some of the confidence of our constituents that says, where was the promise and it didn't happen? You know, and personally, I won't let that happen to myself, because, you know, we've got to have those discussions, and we need to start making sure that we're holding ourselves true to the financial commitments that we're doing when we make these decisions.
Well, I think we have two choices then. Either someone makes a motion to amend this recommendation, and we discuss it and vote on the amendment, or we vote on the original recommendation. I think that's where we are now.
Okay. I'll make the motion that we amend the recommendation for superintendent with 90,000 net net.
Can we say...
No, hang on, Tom.
Oh, sorry.
Motion was made to amend the recommendation to include the subtraction of $90,000 from the current, from the 2013-2014 budget. Yes. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay, that's Mr. Escalante. Mr.
I'll defer if John wants to make a question. It's my second.
Well, you seconded it, right?
I did.
So,
so
you seconded your second.
I seconded.
But my clarification of Patrick's motion, you're still second.
I'll wait for John's comment.
I was just going to say, let's just not pick an arbitrary number, whatever it ends up being. If it's 89,500 or 92,000,
yeah, right.
You know, it's whatever the number is.
And I think we're in the weeds again. This is 0.18% of a $50 million budget, and we're talking about something that the board already talked about, instructed the administration to go out and make these offers. We have a reputation at stake, not only with the taxpayers, but with the pool of candidates who want to attract this school district. We've made those two offers, I believe, at this point. And I think everybody feels the same way. We should be fiscally responsible. There's no doubt about that. We have a whole budget process to go through. But we're doing it again. We're getting down in the weeds, and we're directing around $80,000.
I just don't feel like it's about the money.
Well, before we get into a discussion, we do have a motion on the floor. Is there a second to that motion?
Okay. I second the motion.
Okay. Now we can discuss the
amendment. His amendment is saying it's whatever the number is.
Okay. So now let's discuss this amendment.
I agree that it seems like we're getting in the weeds about this.
I'm concerned about a board that every time we get an amendment, every time we get a motion in front of us, we want to tinker with the motion. And I think that this is something that's been talked about. We've traded a lot of information on this already. We went through, we all acknowledge this is something needed. It seems like everybody's saying that. I think we have a whole budgeting process to go through to say, can we get to the budget, and is there stuff we can take out? Why leave it at 90? Maybe it's $1 million.
Well, I think this is a good start.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But we're
going to
piece it. Yes, but we're starting to combine things at the same time, and I think it's clearer if we have two tentative proposals out right now, job offers to people right now, who are waiting to find out if they should be going to another district to go find a job.
And I think we're agreeing to that, and I think we're saying that the priority, the conversation about the priority of having them and what they'll bring to the table is fine. Just, you know, like you said, let's just make sure that it's self-funded.
In fact, I think what we're saying is yes, go hire them. Isn't the motion?
We're saying yes, go hire them, but then we're also instructing the administration, I believe, unless I'm misunderstanding this, that you can go hire them, and by the way, now you have to go find 89,000 or 90,000 or whatever it turns out to be and come back and bring it back to us. But we also know that at the same time, they may bring us back five more other items that we haven't talked about yet. It could be even more money than that or less money. Because we've been here, we voted on various things brought in front of us. I think we risk it when we start saying, when we start parsing this into little pieces and directing it this way. There's a process that goes under
way, I believe, for a budget that you laid out for us today, Bob, that is important to go through. And I don't, and I just, you know, we can vote on it. I just don't think that it's a good policy to say, okay, we're going to vote on this, but take it off here, because people are going to write that all down like they did when we eliminated these positions, and then they're going to say, you owe me $90,000.
And that's okay, because for me, we want to send that message. I mean, the message that I think I hear Patrick mentioning is, this is an important position, and we want to send a message that we need to amend the budget.
We haven't adopted the budget, so you don't have to amend anything.
That's what I'm getting at. We haven't gotten to that point, and we're already committing that we're going to amend.
You know, I would just like to say, first of all, that the district does develop its expenditure plan based on priorities. The board may choose to change those priorities with a new superintendent, but I certainly don't want to create an impression that we just don't spend against our priorities. And
I was just trying to say, we just haven't gotten together as a new group to talk about those priorities.
Right.
Yeah.
That was a
good,
My preference would be to vote
on the motion that's in front of us, recognizing that this board hasn't had its board workshop to meet to really have those conversations. And with a new superintendent coming in 3 weeks, that's a natural time for us to do, you know, exactly what you and, you know, Joe and Patrick are suggesting. And what John has put on the table, which is to say, what are our, I mean, we were calling them goals in the past, but whatever we call them, what are those priorities and how do they align with what we're doing? So, I don't think by voting on the motion without being amended precludes us from committing to that conversation, because it's even more important with a new superintendent coming in that we lock in and have that discussion. So my preference, my recommendation would be that we go with the initial one, knowing that we have a commitment to having this conversation. And I agree, we got to put some structure and boundaries around it. I don't disagree with that. But we have a new superintendent coming in that will help to bring a lens to that as well.
And keep in mind that the budget is a discussion item that is coming up on the agenda very soon. So we can have that conversation tonight if we really want it. Mm-hmm. But it is what time it is.
That's okay.
All right, so we have an amended motion on the table. Does anyone want to withdraw the motion, or are we going to vote on the motion? Okay, so.
I would just like to ask for clarity on the amended motion so I get it right. So, motion was made to amend the recommendation.
Sounded like it was to for the two assistant principals and whatever the dollar amount to target as a reduction in next year's budget.
That the addition of one person salary for one of those positions must be, that expenditure must be taken from some other place in the budget. Compensated service, zero growth. It's a zero expenditure.
Which salary are we referring to?
So
the 80,000 or the 89,000?
Let's go for the 89,000.
Okay.
Do we have a budget right now?
We'll have to go back and examine that. I mean, the budget is a working document, so I'll go back and look at what that would be. I couldn't tell you that now, and I won't be able to tell you that on Monday. I'll have to. Yeah.
Right, so we need to vote on the amendment. So the main motion of the amendment is to include the subtraction of $89,000 from the 2013-14 budget to make the recommendation a zero-sum gain. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay. Does everybody understand the motion? Everybody understands the motion?
To include the subtraction of $89,000 from the 2013-14 budget to make a recommendation at a zero-sum gain.
Good job.
Yes, that's it.
Are we banning anything else?
Well.
Okay, roll call, please.
I want to clarify that Patrick made the motion.
Patrick made the motion. Joe seconded.
Yep.
Mrs. Nelson?
No.
Mr. Escalante?
Yes.
Mr. Baczynski?
Yes.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Elder?
No.
Mr. Black?
No. Sorry, that was 4-3.
Yes,
the amendment passed. Now, based on
Now we go back to the amended recommendation.
You already did the amended recommendation.
We just did the amended.
So now the other recommendation is moved.
So the other recommendation is moved. Okay, so we move on.
No, what you voted on was amending the main motion.
Right.
Now the main motion has been changed.
Now we
still
have
haven't voted on the main motion.
Oh, that's right. Thank you, Mr. Monkowski. We do have to vote on the new motion.
Okay, so now, Nancy, could you reread the new motion?
The administration recommends the board approve employment of Megan Kuznetsov as assistant principal at Forest Glen Elementary and an annual salary of $80,000, and Darlene Stone as assistant principal at Lincoln Elementary School at an annual salary of $89,000. Includes the subtraction of $89,000 of the 2013-14 budget to make the recommendation at a zero-sum figure.
Thanks, Nancy. May I have a motion to approve the administration's amended recommendation as presented?
Motion. Second.
Motion by Mr. Kenwood, second by Mr. Escalante. Any discussion on this? Okay. Nancy.
Mr. Elger.
Yes.
Mr. Bolchinski.
Yes.
Mr. Kenwood.
Yes.
Mr. Escalante.
Yes.
Mr. Ellis.
Yes.
Nelson.
Yes.
Mr. Blatt.
Yes. Okay. 2013-2014 student fees. Finance Committee was charged with taking another look at student fees for the 2013-2014 school year and determined it's too late in the fiscal year to make changes for next year and has asked the administration to bring the topic back to Finance Committee in the fall for further discussion. The administration recommends that the Board of Education approve the recommendation that there be no increase in student basic and activity fees for the 2013-2014 school year. I have a motion to approve the administration's recommendation as presented.
Motion.
Second.
Are you afraid to say discussion?
Did you get the motion in the second?
Mr. Ellis, Mr. Bushinsky? Is that correct?
Yes. Discussion.
We did talk about this in finance and realized that it was so late in the game to truly vet it out and the impact of taking fees totally off the table, but realizing that we want to move this forward, we're going to go ahead and leave it as is. But again, continuing with the budget conversations in the next year, readdress fees as a continuing source of revenue for the school district. But
any other discussion?
When Bob brought up the slides before, did you say that 6% came from fees or fees and other things?
It's other local revenue. So it's fees, meaning student fees and collective, lunch fees, interest revenue, anything locally generated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, this was my kind of baby, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And the basic student fee was $250,000.
$259,000 or something.
Okay. And Ann and I had a conversation about this, and I also agreed that it was too late in the game to make any changes for the 2013-14 school year. And I also am interested in revisiting the issue for the next budget with the same interest I had before. So I'd agree with the recommendation as well. Any other discussion?
Tim, I hear what you're saying, and we're having some discussion about it as well. I would ask Bob to put that on top of our list for things to talk about at the first finance committee in the office.
Well, I'd add to the second thing, Bob, because you have to find $89,000 first, and then try to find $250,000 next. Okay, anything, any other discussion? Roll call, please, Mrs. Brown.
Mrs. Nelson, yes. Mr. Bolchinski?
Yes.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Mr. Escalante?
Yes.
Mr. Elder?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Blatt?
Yes. Superintendent's report.
You have your enrollment report in front of you, and I'm just going to give you a very brief update on the work that has been occurring so far this summer with 21st Century Learning and planning for CD. We've got class placements are underway. Building schedules are almost finalized at the buildings. We're in the same spot that we would be normally at this time, near completion, but not ready to release them as we typically do in August. And every school had a simulated experience in the spring for 21st Century Learning. The meet and greet is scheduled for August 22nd. The Team 21 is working on the PLC schedule, the parent-teacher conference schedules, and the multi-age professional development is being worked on by PDT, which I'll talk to a little bit later. We've got organizational work happening for both levels, 2 and 3. They've been given 6 hours to work. Teams will be working on just the organizational aspects of the change next year to content-based teaching. And literacy is working in those grade level teams too to plan their units around the literacy modules, and the student teachers are also coming together at each of the buildings to work on implementing the science curriculum for next year. And what they've already determined is that level 2, which is all second and third grade students, will experience the human body and force and motion from the third grade curriculum and magnetism and electricity from the fourth grade curriculum. Level 3, all fourth and fifth grade students will do the inquiry, cells, solar system, and weather. So everything is underway, and August 19th will be first professional development day, which will include time to work in a professional learning community teams as well as do the curriculum updates from the work this summer on both literacy and math. And on the 20th, there will be multi-age professional development for teachers in level 3 and done by some of our colleagues in District 54. So, quick update on it.
Thank you. Board reports. Any board committee reports or any other board reports?
Real quickly, CIT had its last meeting, which is actually it was a rescheduled meeting for the last CIT group, which was on June 7th. And one of the things I wanted to mention is that we had a review of our Hadley math update, which is actually excellent. Karen Carlson provided that for us. And really looking at curriculum that's going to align with the Common Core, but also align with some of our AEC, which is our, for lack of a better description, gifted program, where some of that math is already being used. So I was happy to hear that, and that the teachers have done their due diligence to look at piloting two programs so that they can identify one of which we already use, what would be best in terms of moving forward. So a lot of work around that I thought was quite good. And then the work we did in small groups with regard to the scorecard, and Ann mentioned this briefly in terms of the summary, was around looking at the scorecard. And, you know, we talk a lot and we hear a lot from constituents about, you know, kind of business-based language in terms of what how we use that. Well, clearly a scorecard, any of us that work in business and use scorecards or dashboards know the value of those. And for the work that CIT is doing as that umbrella organization to the other teams for excellence, is to really look at what's manageable on the scorecard and CIT's role in managing that information. So what's important to put on there, which are good snapshots of the community for community members, parents, taxpayers, folks to get a real snapshot of what's going on in the district. And so CIT will continue that work as well. And so Sam will talk over that. The other quick report is the Teams for Excellence that I mentioned, and their schedule runs as follows. Team 21 members who are now the Teams for Excellence, which used to be on the leadership team, met last week, June 4th and 6th from 8:30 to noon. This week, 11th, 13th, 12:30 to 3:30, and then the 18th, 19th, 20th, 25, 26, 27, and 29 and 31 will be meeting 8:30 to noon. To do work on 4 key areas. One is the professional learning community schedule, which was just a labor last week sitting in that and watching them work through this. So it's a ton of work, but really, really committed team members to that, seeing the value of professional learning communities. We'll be working on parent-teacher conferences. We got some support literature from Karen and Kelly King, who is her co-chair on that. We'll be looking at evaluating the implementation, which I know is an important piece for the board. The previous board had voted to move Think Tank forward. It is no longer Think Tank. Think Tank provided the recommendation. It is now 21st Century Learning. That's what we're prepping and implementing. So evaluating implementation, and then looking at building community and social emotional needs. So a lot of really important work this summer for that group, and I will do my best to keep you informed. One idea that I had in listening last week and brought to Julie Worthen for a kind of a high-level discussion was to develop a kind of a brief glossary of terms for parents as we talk about level one, level two, level three, and what that translates into. And so we're going to talk about that in a little more depth so that we can have some kind of onboarding information for parents so they have a sense of what they're walking into and can get up to speed pretty quickly. So that was one takeaway from that.
Anyone else? I'll just briefly add that I attended the May 30th CIT meeting, so I'm not going to add any more than
that transition.
Right. Anything else? Okay. Discussion items.
Our first discussion item is relative to adopting an amendment to our 457 tax-deferred retirement plan with the district so that we can move to the governance of that plan to a third-party administrator, similar to what we do with the 403B. That takes us out of not only that manpower, but also the liability that's associated with administering those plans.
Mm-hmm. Any cost to the administration or the district?
There's the $38 a month fee. And the more people, we have a lower number of people.
There's a half dozen people involved in it or something.
Right. If we have more people, that cost will go down.
Yes.
As it's administered by a third-party plan, it's possible that that cost will go down.
Any other questions or comments?
The only comment I have, this is really nitpicky. So on page 74 of the board book packet that we got, there's a section 4.05 that talks about distribution prior to severance. There's a part C, and it has two boxes checked, and I think we only are supposed to have one. So we might have, there's three different choices, and I think we accidentally checked two of the boxes.
Two of them, right.
And it should have only been one, so we want to fix that.
Are you saying 4.05 B and C?
4.05 part C. It says check one box, one, two, or three. Let me see.
Sorry, Dean, what page are you
on? 74.
It's on page 74.
Choose one, two, or three.
And we have chosen one participant election and two mandatory distribution.
Choose one of A or B.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I am in the weeds. I have to sign this. I have to sign this. I am in the weeds.
You'll get clarification.
Okay, yeah.
Well, it does say choose one of A or B as applicable, and then choose C or and D as a, so it might be.
It may be both are appropriate.
It actually says choose one of one, two, or three where I'm at.
On my page.
One and two.
And we have chosen one and two.
You know what?
Okay. And I can give it to you.
Yeah.
We'll do it later.
Yeah.
But
that would be good.
That would be a good email.
There's a lot of pages in this.
We can take that
there
off.
Yeah. You're a good reader. Hey.
Anything else on this? Okay. Good.
Next item is related to our food service agreement amendment to that, which is related to offering the morning, the breakfast program, which we are mandated by law to do, with 40% and over 40% of free and reduced lunches at Churchill. So this just takes our current agreement with
Marquardt
15 and adjust it to include the breakfast program.
Mm-hmm. So we're only amending it because of the new mm-hmm. breakfast program. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And will other children be able to?
Maybe next year, but not. I mean, maybe not the first. Maybe the year after next.
Right. Once
we'll see how. Yeah. See, I mean, any child at Churchill is eligible and can participate.
Mm-hmm.
But whether we open it up to other schools will depend on what we learn this next year.
Any other questions or comments on this? Okay.
Okay. Next report is our supplemental pay report. We brought this to Finance Committee last board meeting or last meeting. There was some questions raised. I do want to indicate, especially for Finance Committee members, we've made some adjustments in this because what wasn't included in our first report was that we are also eliminating our science coordinators at a savings of $9,200, so that the overall savings with the recommendation we're making is $6,900. The one thing that's noteworthy in this is, you know, it's a combination of having we have one new group, SafeSpot, which we're asking for as a new group to be added to the supplemental pay structure, and then the others, the Hadley Choir, the Hadley Band, is a reorganization of current stipends and looking at the level that is needed because of the number of students that participate. And so there is a request in here for a one-time payment to the band directors because of the work they did this year and because of the calendar that kind of prohibited us from bringing this recommendation forward earlier due to negotiations that were ongoing and an inability to really address through the Supplemental Pay Committee what they requested, which was a need to increase supervision based on the number of students participating.
So are those one-time stipends included in the savings of $6,800?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The one-time payment, you'll notice, is the second item in the financial summary.
And there's only one one-time payment.
Correct.
It's on the last page.
We discussed this at the finance committee last time. One thing I want to note for everybody, because we talked a lot about precedent and all that, and being very careful, and it came up that because the contract is still being negotiated, you couldn't review these. The simple math is, to do it, if I get it correct, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's an increase of roughly 60 students. The students pay fees for these activities. The fees, if you do an average between the second and the first fee, it's about $2,250. So it exceeds the stipend that would be in this approval.
Okay.
So it's paid for plus that.
Okay.
The other thing, I think Lori gave me some information for the last time that I wanted to know what the delta was in between this year and the prior year.
I'm not sure.
Total
delta of what? Total stipend?
Total stipend, Drew?
What's it?
Of the total stipend?
Oh, for the different groups of supplemental pay.
All of the groups of supplemental pay. Oh, and you sent that to him. That's you, and you sent that to him, and that.
That was very, very helpful. And the delta between last year and this year is very. It's a minimal number. It's the minimum. So.
And the fact that the new contract has a fixed rate for stipends over the course of the contract, they don't increase every year as previously has occurred.
That was it. One of those sustainability things that we've done.
Yep.
I just want to mention, because this gets lost sometimes, but the Supplemental Pay Committee, and I serve on that, and what I said to Sam was starting next year, 2014, as I finish up final year as a board member, that I want to bring another board member on board to do transition, because the committee meets, what do you meet, three or four times a year, and it's pretty structured, and so it will be good to have a second board member, you know, go on it with me. It's been a really good committee to serve on, to understand some of the interests that certainly our students have, but also where teachers really step up to provide those activities that, you know, some other school districts don't have. What I'm glad to see is that we really have done a good job, in particular the last 3 or 4 years, on sunsetting activities that we don't need. As kids roll out and the interest isn't there, we don't just keep them on for you know, the sake of doing that, but sunsetting and saving those dollars. So it was nice to see that we were able to capture that money. So, good.
Anything else?
We'll bring this back the 24th for action. And the next item is the 2014-15 budget. And you had an opportunity to hear from Bob, the overview of the budget. The budget now will need one more revision, which is, you know, common. We'll be doing revisions anyway. But at this point, are there any questions on the actual budget and what our next steps will be?
Any questions?
I need to go through it with the board if I do come to that. I know, Bob, you're welcome to us emailing you or calling, so I'll take that road.
Okay. We will be asking for action so that it can go on display as a tentative budget with final action to be taken in last meeting of, or the first meeting of August. Okay. Final discussion item is a request to for additional math STEAM teacher to be shared between Forest Glen and Ben Franklin School to accommodate the new Common Core standards and the changes in the curriculum that are being done this summer, as well as to prepare and incorporate these specialists into the STEAM curriculum, which will be developed next year.
And the specialists work with the staff.
Work with staff and students. We would be looking for this position to provide intervention to some of our 30% and below students in math, since we don't have any intervention specialists for that, as well as provide coaching, as they typically do. So it would be a combination of both of those.
Do we have a large number of students at Churchill?
Much larger.
That meet the 30% level?
Yeah. You can see in the table that Karen's put together on the first page that the number of students on our map, as we've introduced more Common Core questions into the map, that we have an increased number of students who are in the 30th percentile and below. And we also have an expectation next year that all of our teachers will be teaching guided math, and so needing the specialists to help guide that process and ensure implementation of the guided math in order to differentiate and meet the needs of all the students. And then finally, to have some additional support to meet, to do interventions with particular students.
Any other discussion, questions, comments?
Karen, would you add anything to that?
The RTI process is another huge responsibility of all theirs, and the more teachers have it, tier two and tier three, the more they monitor all that data and bring it to the community. So. And Karen, RTI response intervention, quick description of that again.
Well, it really was kind of the alternative to the formal way of identifying kids in special education. Mm-hmm. But in other words, you have to kind of look at your data and those kids who are performing below a certain percentile, particularly the 20th percentile below, that you must do something, some kind of intervention. Progress monitor that data. Usually every 2 weeks in that, you come back to the table to make some decisions on whether you'll continue with that intervention or increase the intervention in some way. It could be alternative materials, maybe different settings, a one-on-one, whatever the particular needs are. And the hope is to prevent kids having to go that special ed route. However, if they're responding to the intervention usually needs to continue. If you remove the intervention away, kind of what happens. So it parallels programs in some respects that special ed process. But you're still monitoring the data just like you do if you're a high school student.
Thank you. Just let me have that description again.
One thing, when you look at the numbers from 2012 to 2013, we talked about this was not on our agenda, the finance committee today. Mm-hmm. You can look at the number of students per math specialist, and we're really, those numbers show you that you need to add math specialists, because you're at 118 per math specialist in 2012, and the proposal will go about 110 plus students per math specialist. I think if you look at those numbers, the way the recommendation is, it's dividing them up pretty equally with the more burden at Churchill. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's a sound business approach to the numbers that are in front of you as far as resources.
And I think with the finance, it's all kind of flowing together now tonight. But I think with the finance that you also mentioned that part of the discussion around a math specialist was started last year.
with regard to the Common Core standards and how we were going to have to intervene on that. So I think that that was important for me to have reinforced. And I remember you saying that it was good to have that reinforced in the Internet Finance Committee, because there is conversation, and I understand this, that that this position is in direct correlation to the 21st century learning that we're doing in the fall with those structural changes, et cetera. But in fact, this conversation was...
It's really related to the implementation of the Common Core and the need to accelerate and compact our curriculum and advance it by 1 year for every grade level. And and that combined with, as Joe noted, the increased number of students who are in the 30th percentile. And so that kind of collision of demand.
Right.
But it was something that we discussed bringing back to the board last year and chose not to.
So it's not tied to the think tank?
It is not. It's really tied to the combination of the Common Core curriculum revisions that we need to make, and then creating specialization in the STEAM, so that when that STEAM curriculum is built, we've got people who can also specialize in that.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. Upcoming meetings, June 24, 2013, Master Facilities Update and regular board meeting, 6 p.m. Please note the time change there, Central Services Office. Other matters. Does the board have any other matters it wishes to discuss?
I hate to do this, but I just have one because it's kind of sensitive. So I'll make it quick. Each April, board members receive a letter from the IASB around the resolution process. And so when Sam had his first president's meeting, he and I were supposed to meet, and we realized, uh-oh, you already have something scheduled. So I sat in on that. And after we had the legislative forum on April 22nd with Senator Dillard and Representative Pijos and Patty Agnos from Rent, et cetera, there was a question that was brought up about unfunded and underfunded mandates, which we've heard a lot about tonight with regard to the push on needs and interests in terms of our assistant principals. So the question came up, and I talked to Representative Pijos about this, being a district budget planning issue. It certainly will address needs and interests of taxpayers, because those unfunded and underfunded mandates, while they're not all K through 8, certainly we've been impacted by them over the years, and I know we'll continue to. So what I talked to Sam about and Ann is that that I would do a little due diligence on whether or not there had been any kind of resolution around legislators needing to inject more time into the process in order for financial or technical or training logistical impact for boards to be able to give testimony around before a mandate is passed. And so I talked to the government relations director at the IASB. Her name is Deanna Sullivan. And she gave me an interesting statistic. Between 1991 and 1999, there were 12 under or unfunded mandates passed. Between 2000 and 2013, there were 116. And so, we know that the work of the legislator is to write bills. So what she did tell me is that she brought this back to her team. So I talked with her the end of last week. And the government relations team at least feels like that this may have some legs right now, because the legislature is looking at how do we rein in some of this and create better communications. So they're having some of that conversation, surprisingly enough. The other thing she mentioned is that there is a current requirement, although not consistently applied, called an impact note, which is supposed to indicate the financial impact of a new law. And she said that's not consistently applied. Some legislators do it, but there's nobody holding, feet to the fire in order to do that. So I'm waiting to hear if the IASB will find this resolution worthwhile to pursue, meaning that it has to have some practical application for legislators. But I thought, as a board, from a governance perspective, since we have that legislative conversation, and this came up in part around that, that it might be worthwhile to pursue at least some draft language that Deanna Sullivan would help me write.
So what I'm asking is that there's the potential on the 24th, if something gets framed, I would certainly get it out early to Sam and Ann to get out to the board. But the possibility that the board might support moving forward with further look at some resolution around this. So there's that possibility. So we'll see. And I wanted to bring you up to date and let the board know.
Okay.
I have one quick other, and that is simply that board members need to notify me by Wednesday if you support attending the III conference, which I shared the information with you in the last Thursday letter, and whether or not you would intend to support staying overnight on Friday night. So if you'll let me know by Wednesday what your intention is on that and what your preference is, that would be great.
So I think it's two things. One, attending the conference, and two, staying overnight.
Right. We need to know both, because obviously there are hotel accommodations that need to be made, and then the registration.
Motion.
Okay. Public participation. Are there any members of the public present who wish to address the board at this time? Mr. Cooper
and Mr.
And Mr. Cooper,
Okay.
As you spoke earlier, could you make your comments?
Yeah, I'm going to order to that one. First of all, I feel like the patron saint of lost causes, since you guys already know it, but I wanted to get this on the record, and I want you to be aware of it. First of all, if there's any doubt of bullying, I think you saw it tonight with the flowers being passed out. I thought that was obnoxious at the highest level. I mean, it was an intimidation factor, I felt. And Mr. Kenwood, I was glad that you identified that. And my request to the board, I don't know how to put this officially into the board's things to do, but that there be administrative action taken against the teachers. I saw one T-shirt tonight that had that freedom written on it. I don't know if that was a teacher, but I think this needs to be nipped in the bud, no pun intended with the flower, because it's not acceptable. If I was that student, I would have felt totally intimidated. If I was that student's parent, I would have felt intimidated. I don't think there's any room for that. So I thank you for the parental notice, but I think we lost an opportunity tonight, and I realized I wasn't clear. I think the book should have still been banned. And I'll leave you with these two thoughts. One is that it's my understanding that assaults on women are increasing. But even if that's not true, even if it's the same or even gradually increasing or decreasing, one is too many. And if the trajectory of our society is going down, do we need to do that as well? And I look at your sign and it says Inspire Excellence. Having this book in the curriculum or as a potential, I don't believe inspires excellence. And the last point is the Bechtold test for women. This was written by a feminist. It talks about movies specifically, but media in particular. Are there two or more women? Do they talk? Do they talk about something other than getting the guy? And this is again a movie. And is their success deemed anything other than getting the guy? And again, this book in particular, but just the curriculum in general, is it the likelihood that women are going to feel more respected as a result of having this material being openly read in the classroom? And sadly, I have a daughter that's 5, and I feel like she's facing an uphill battle because of this decision. So, again, thank you for banning her for the parental notice, but again, I missed an opportunity tonight. But I hope you'll keep these thoughts in mind as I move forward. Thank you.
Mr. Cooper.
I'll sit here if that's okay. I'd like to say I appreciate the discussion that you had on the assistant principal on the subject. I trust that you, after the budget is taken care of, that you will notify the public as to what the existing expenditure is for zeroed out to get a zero balance. And that, to me, that's a trust issue. And I'm willing to go ahead and see what brings the trust forward to me and some others. As far as the one-year contract goes, when that was brought forward, it was about our governor talking about the temporary tax.
we might even have to have a conversation on this.
The temporary what?
The temporary income tax. At the risk of kicking these, but quickly, regarding the May 28th Finance Committee recommendation of posting the breakdown of the MasterCard bill and declining and deciding not to have free subscription of each District 41 check and check listing. What I heard on the audio is that the reason for each check not needing free subscription and the listing to have was that this was not in the best use of the district's time, meaning the finance department's time. And I noticed that there are seven people in the finance department, including two administrative assistants. And somehow the Glen Ellyn Park District does find time every month in their agenda to list all the vendors that they have and whatever the reason is for paying each vendor. I trust that this is not going to have that. Phone calls placed by inquiring people such as myself with the answer, even if it means that every week will be asked as to what it was for. The board should reconsider this policy, though, or not go ahead and make this change. The Make Transparency Project claim is seem hollow. Transparency, opaqueness, it's a fine line, and can't cross it unless you are it. And in this case, we're not on the right side of the internet. Also, it needs to be brought up that in the 4 months of the MasterCard bills that I FOIA'd, a total of 45 people, that's 45 different people,
30 seconds,
charged items on the MasterCard. If any of the board members are business owners, could you see this happening in your business? I know the answer is absolutely not. I'd love to hear an explanation from the financial department, from the finance department, on how it stays on top of this with 45 people using that card and why. 12 people from one school, Hadley, use the card. Is there no centralization? What a mess. An annual board audit doesn't cut it for this kind of expense if you're under $50,000 a month.
That's time. Could you summarize? Are you done, sir?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else, Mrs. Moss?
Sarah Howard. Got my own timer. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen to the community of a lot of different people. I want to thank you for going back and looking at a policy that clearly needed to be updated and fixing something that was done not with any malice, but being that I was sitting there kind of swept up in the emotion of what happened. I'd like to thank you for acknowledging a group of students who embodied what this vision and what this mission and every one of those learner characteristics that we have taught, not me, the students, our staff, had taught these kids for many years. They are the embodiment of what it is that we do. I also would like to remind you guys that when you read emails from constituents or perhaps not constituents, that you guys do the homework. There was a lot. There were a lot of inaccuracies of information that were shared this evening that were incorrect. These teachers stood up for that student and many other students if there was a problem in a classroom. Many of these discussions were not initiated by the teachers. They were initiated by students asking questions, working on projects that occurred way before this censorship issue came forward. So I ask you, just do your homework before you make accusations against our staff members, because they are your staff, they are our staff, and we're here to make sure that they are held to the same standard that all of us are, but we also need to acknowledge they do the right thing. I'd like to remind you guys that bullying goes both ways. A group of students brought flowers tonight to show their solidarity. And while you may call that bullying, I would also call it bullying when somebody brings their Bible to school.
Mrs. Howard, please address the board.
And called my child a sinner. So we learn and we teach our children to respect alternate points of view. And I appreciate the fact that you guys acknowledge that this evening. Thank you, and I'm sure that the policy and the procedures will be updated in the future.
Thank you. Anyone else?
We did have someone leave their statement, but he didn't want to wait for the end of the meeting, so I'll go ahead and copy that.
Okay. Yeah, we'll just add it.
It's related to the vote. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's a nice thing.
The board has determined there's a need to adjourn to closed session to discuss the following matters. Collective negotiating matters between the district and its employees or their representatives, or deliberations concerning salary schedules for one or more classes of employees. The appointment, employment, compensation, discipline, performance, or dismissal of specific employees.
That's for 3 minutes.
Of the district or legal counsel for the district, including hearing testimony and complaint lodged against an employee or against legal counsel for the district to determine its validity. We have a motion to adjourn to closed session.
Motion.
Second. Motion by Mr. Kenwood. I believe Mr. Elger has the second. Roll call, please.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Ms. Brochinski?
Yes.
Mr. Escalante?
Yes.
Mr. Elger?
Yes.
Mrs. Elson? Yes. Mr. Black?
Yes.
No action.
The board will not be taking action on return to open session.